Good morning. I'm going to call the meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order and note the attendance around the dais. And I should announce that, unfortunately for her, Geraldine Natz didn't make her flight, so she will be coming in about an hour, but she just missed the appropriate flight from Los Angeles. And so, under welcome and council member announcements, I think we have not met since February, in part because we have had a change in staff, but there's a lot going on. And I want to acknowledge that this is the first meeting for Catherine Cat Coleman, the new director for the Ocean Protection Council, who is also the Deputy Secretary for Oceans and Resources. And we have worked really hard to consolidate the oceans programs together so that we can try to work in a much more focused and organized fashion. And for those of you that don't know Kat, she worked for many years at Region 9 of the Environmental Protection Agency. She most recently served as the executive officer for the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, and we're really happy to have her on board and working and moving ahead. And on just a few items, since we last met, the designation has been made for the North Coast on the Marine Life Protection Act. The Fish and Game adopted it in June. I'm personally very pleased with that progress because that was a compromise among stakeholders and included the progress that we've made with tribes on tribal inclusion in the process. And as I've said before in this group, it was unique because if you looked back at what might be about 2 years ago right now, there were strong differences and it was not clear that there would be a unified proposal and that kind of progress, and it was not clear that there would be work to include the tribes, and that has happened, and I think it's landmark. And the state is working actively on the evaluation of the MPAs on the Central Coast because that was the first designation. There's a milestone of time since that happened. And a symposium is going to be held next year, February 27th to March 1st, in Monterey to review the monitoring results. So that is moving forward. And at our last meeting, we approved the OPC Ocean Protection Council strategic plan. Copies are available in the back of the room. And I want to once again thank everybody that worked so hard on that document. It represented significant outreach to stakeholders, whether it was scientists, agencies, members of the public, NGOs. And the plan is thoughtful and valuable in providing a strategic vision to those of us here. Also, as just anecdotally, we've been able to note that just due to wind patterns and upwelling, this is an amazing year for whales off the California coast. And I've certainly noticed it on the weekends I spend in the Monterey Bay Area. And the endangered blue and humpback whales are feeding near the California shores, and it's caused great excitement. And also, the Ocean Protection Act that set up the Ocean Protection Council has been shortlisted for the World Future Council's Future Vision Award. It's an international award from the World Future Council. It celebrates effective and exemplary policies. The topic of the 2012 award is the protection of oceans and coasts. COPA is one of six policies from five countries that have been shortlisted for the award. It'll be announced at the United Nations headquarters in New York this month. And the World Future Council is an international policy research organization that provides decision makers with effective policy solutions and created the award to create awareness for good policy solutions. Today's agenda is a demonstration of, hopefully, a demonstration of the type of work that's been exemplified and resulting in that nomination, because we are seeking input from the scientific community to help guide the state on complex issues and members of the public. And also, just in housekeeping, if you wish to speak on an item, there are speaker slips, and if you deliver them right there, they will get to me so that I can call on you in the appropriate item. And we are working really hard to be done by 2 o'clock today, so we will have that as our goal for a number of reasons. With that, I would ask if there are any announcements or comments from other members before we move on to the rest of our agenda. Rodriguez.
Thank you. I'd just like to also welcome Kat to this meeting. I really look forward to working with you. You know, everybody at the state board and at the regional board says wonderful things about you. I've found them to be true. And the well, I don't always find the things I'm told by the state board staff to be true, but in this case, I found them to be true.
And I actually might want to read that statement into the records of other items.
In any event, I did want to welcome you to the new position officially, and I look forward to working with you. And then I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I'm very pleased that Supervising Deputy Attorney General Dan Siegel is here. I had the pleasure of working with Dan for a number of years, more than we want to recount, in the Attorney General's office. And I just want to assure Dan that I've forgotten everything that I ever knew about the law. And so I'm counting on him to keep me on the straight and narrow today. So.
Now that's a full-time job.
It is.
And I appreciate him being here as well. I just worked with him on Tahoe, and I was beginning to wonder how Tahoe was interacting with oceans when I walked in the door and saw him. Any other comments from members? Then we will move to the report from the executive director, item number 2.
I'm told it's better done from down here. Mr. Chair, council members, I really want to thank you for the opportunity to be your executive director. I'm honored to be able to serve in this capacity and hope that my passion for the ocean and coast and the experience in managing complex environmental issues will translate here into excellent service to the council and leadership to the staff and the ocean community. It's challenging, but surely it will be a rewarding adventure for all of us. This is my first council meeting, so noted, and also the first meeting for my executive assistant, Joanna Stone, who is upstairs helping with many other tasks, but I wanted to thank her. I also want to thank Sam Shuckett for his help in this transition and his leadership in creating an excellent OPC team. The staff is really awesome. Most particularly, at this point, I want to thank Mary Small. Mary is a Conservancy Deputy Director and has been absolutely invaluable, and I can't express how grateful I am for her readiness to help doing whatever needed to be done in getting ready for this meeting and in getting me up to speed. With that background, before I dive in the report, I also want to thank the ocean community for the really warm welcome that they've given me. The splendid presentation and issue papers have been absolutely invaluable. But most of all, everyone's words of encouragement, as I have found my sea legs, has meant the world to me. And with that, this ship is ready to sail. So I have a short presentation on the budget. And I, of course, cannot read those from here. You see what I mean? There she is. Okay, so what I want to do is, in very brief order, walk you through where both the Prop 84 money has gone as well as the staffing. And the point being that while there has been other funds that have gone to OPC, Prop 84 is the big chunk of change. So we started out with a capital of about $82 million. Of that, $57 million has been awarded. And we have $4 million, which is in unexpended reimbursed, which is both money that we need to front for like federal grants, and so we keep a pot there for fronting the federal grants, and they will pay us back, as well as then the dust bunny change that comes in for grants that don't spend all their money. And that gets rolled over then every year. So that leaves us with $29 million of unexpended funds for this program. That next. So then breaking out where the money has actually gone, of the money that we have spent to date, of the $57 million. Now, I'm going to acknowledge that this particular pie chart could be done in other ways. This was just a cut. Some of the items, the grants really come in several different categories, but this was just one way to characterize them. And so, as you can see, $44 million went to the MLPA effort. And this afternoon, this morning, I hope, you'll have a presentation on the MLPA, and Claire O'Reilly of the OPC staff will dive into that in some detail about where the money went. But it basically was spent on baseline monitoring, seafloor mapping, as well as then staffing at DFG and OPC to make the effort occur. Then for the rest of the money, the other big chunk has been, as you would imagine, for fisheries and ecosystem kinds of efforts, and then diminishing amounts, as you can read for yourself. And I would note, though, the geospatial data is just like a little teeny sliver. And obviously, that would have been bigger if we'd put like the seafloor mapping in that. It would have expanded, and that's what I mean. Kind of depends where you put things. So with that, next is what we haven't spent yet, which is the $29 million. And what we have here on this chart is the uncommitted money and then a chunk of money that is what I call bespoken money, meaning that the council has made promises but not made the final decision to award the money. And of that committed, that bespoken money, the big chunk again is for MLPA. Now, this money is, again, you'll hear this at morning or afternoon, will be hugely leveraged by private investment. So it's a lot of money for us, but it's going to be hugely leveraged. $4 million to the sustainable seafood to do fishery management plans. Climate change, $2.5 million, which would go to updating some local coastal zone plans for a few some communities under the direction of the Coastal Commission, and then $2 million for geospatial data. So my sense is when you look at this, the story is with the money. So what I would propose is that staff, we've known this has been true, but it's time for staff to turn and start looking at options for funding. There are some obvious things that are out there, such as, the rigs to reef and once through cooling, and there's some other options, but to start a serious effort of looking at what kind of money, how long will this money that we have last for projects, and then what do we want to do in the future. So the last slide I have is a snapshot of the staffing. And these figures are rough. They don't have all of the overhead totally ground into them. But most of the money, as you can see, is from license plate, both at the conservancy and at resources. And then some money that is in Prop 84, and so that is staffing that will disappear along with the Prop 84 money. And then we have a federal grant that we also receive. And so that's the total picture we have on funding. So with that, I'll take questions. And Mary is here to answer any real questions.
Actually, I'd like to make a comment rather than a question, which is that I want to thank you for this. And one of the big surprises that I had when I started this was that there was no formal annual budget that was presented, that their spending authority and things had been done in many ways as they had been done before, and that you could not see this aggregate in any particular chart or discrete location. And I was genuinely surprised by that. If you couple that with the recent thing I was generally surprised about in parks, there are certain mechanisms that I made assumptions. I made assumptions that it was hard to imagine there would be a quasi-state agency that did not have a budget, much less the other one. And so I think that what we would like to do is something like this on an annual basis so that people see where we are. And when you look at the bond money, the Prop 84 that came by earlier, I think the real issue there is that we have, compared to what has been spent thus far, a smaller amount that's left, and some of it has in essence been promised, and it requires, as was just inferred by the director, it requires that we start to be strategic both in how we spend heading forward, how we look for new sources, and that it raises the responsibility on us to leverage money with whatever we do spend, which I think we have had the luxury in the prior years of not having that pressure and moving just straight through it. And I think now that's why anytime anybody asks for something, it's going to be, is there a match? What is coming with it? Does it leverage money that wouldn't come to Oceans in another way unless we're doing that? Certain things are going to have to be the questions that we ask when we move forward and do that. And we're going to have to be very serious about looking at those other sources, because at some point we will not have Prop 84 money. And in essence, unless we have new responsibilities, we will be the top policy level, but we won't have the capability or the capacity that we have had in previous years. So it is very important that we see this and that we start to think about this. And I thank you for just coming in the door and working really hard to get on top of it. And I think the last comment with it is that when you look at the strategic plan and the things that are set out in the strategic plan, it means we really have to prioritize within the strategic plan, and we have to prioritize with what little money is left relative to what was there before, what to do. And I don't think anybody can make any assumptions that we will automatically evenly distribute it to the priorities. I think we're going to have to look at what we can leverage. Is there something that is more important? Is there something that gets us a lot more, regardless of trying to spend equally in those priorities? And so we're just going to have those kinds of decisions and that lay of the land coming forward. And I just wanted to highlight it for the people that work with us and follow the Ocean Protection Council.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So are there any other questions or comments on the director's report?
I have one more item, which is just that it's just a housekeeping item that we've been working with your schedulers to produce a schedule for next year, and I hope in November we will have that, as well as some proposals to begin moving forward on spending some of that remaining money. Thank you.
Any questions? Then we'll move to item number 3, which is the report from the science advisor.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the council, and I'm committed to your 2:00 deadline today, so I'm going to keep this very brief, but I've got 3 things I'd like to update you on. One is that your science advisory team has been hard at work. That's not me, I turned my phone off. We met. We met in April, and in a working meeting. We're planning for our next meeting that's coming up in November, and I'm very gratified and excited that you'll be joining us for part of that. And in the interim, the science advisory team continues to work on behalf of California. They're working alongside the Department of Fish and Game to think about scientific collecting permits in and around MPAs. There's a project underway to help us understand the potential impacts of climate change on California's fisheries. And my second item is that we actually have 2 vacancies on that team. That's a team of 24 people. And I'm working closely with Kat Coleman, as well as the executive committee of the science advisory team, to identify what expertise we want to see in the next coming 2 and 3 years. And once we identify that, we'll initiate a public process, where we seek nominations for those seats. They're highly sought after, but not very well compensated. So, and then the third thing, just quickly, is that following on the implementation of MLPA on the North Coast, the monitoring enterprise team is up there undertaking a series of meetings with elected officials, as well as tribal communities, as well as all kinds of stakeholders, fishing communities, and so forth, to learn what are the unique attributes, what are the unique values of the North Coast, so that we can begin to build a very thoughtful and science-informed baseline monitoring plan and monitoring plan on top of that. So that work is underway, and it's very exciting, and that's all I have for you today.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments from members? Thank you. Seeing none, we'll move to item number 4, which is ocean acidification. Let me turn this over to Kat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Skyly and I are going to tag team this. Mr. Laird asked for this item to be put on the agenda, and Skyly and I gave some thought to it of how we can use the expertise that there is within the state of California to get some good science recommendations back to the council about, you know, what do we know, what do we not know about ocean acidification, and what do we need to do, should we be pursuing any management recommendations in the near term. And so Skyly has a proposal, and we know this is urgent and important, and so I'll turn it over to you, Skyly.
Well, thank you very much, Kat. And I want to just take a few more minutes of the council's time to provide a little bit of background on the topic of ocean acidification. It's often it's a confusing and sometimes counterintuitive issue. So just by way of some background, we've obviously all heard a great deal about ocean acidification recently. It's a relatively new field of study that has held the interest and attracted the interest of a variety of researchers from across many, many disciplines. They often haven't been working together, and now they are. The term ocean acidification is broadly used to describe the ongoing decrease in pH in our Earth's oceans, and that's resulting from the uptake of anthropogenic CO2. So while the oceans themselves are not acidic, nor do we ever expect them to be, and there's various mechanisms in place that will keep that from happening, the trend and the change in their chemistry is trending toward more acidic. So hence the term ocean acidification, and at least we're not saying ocean de-alkalinification. So we will count our stars there. That's right. Frankly, I've been practicing that for a week. But about a third of the CO2 in the atmosphere is absorbed by the oceans, and as that amount of carbon dioxide has risen by human activities, we are burning fossil fuels and we're deforesting and perpetrating various other crimes on the planet. The amount of CO2 that's been absorbed by the ocean has risen accordingly. We've experienced a 30% increase in acidity, decrease in pH, in the surface waters in the last two centuries, and with current emissions projections, this trend will steepen. By 2100, ocean acidity will again double or triple, and those are very big numbers, and you owe me for not sparing us all the chemistry and logarithmic charts and stuff that could go along with this, but... I just need you to trust me here. Besides atmospheric loading of CO2, there are local stressors that contribute to a low pH in ocean water. And for example, natural oceanographic processes bring deep water to the surface along coastlines in the Northern Hemisphere. This happens on the western edges of continents, such as our own west coast. And this process, I think we're all familiar with, is called upwelling. And this is driven both by prevailing winds and the rotation of the Earth. Hence, I don't see a management nexus. I mean, but this nutrient-rich water supports the incredible productivity that we enjoy here in California. But that same water is lower in pH than ambient surface water, largely due to the countless billions of animals who have respired and expired in that deep old water. And as it comes up to the surface along our coast, it brings that low pH water up and is, of course, a part of this larger acidification puzzle for us to tease apart. Other local stressors include pollution, such as nutrients, nitrogen from fertilizers and sewage. For example, lower pH, it promotes a phytoplankton bloom and a subsequent zooplankton bloom. Those guys die, those guys breathe, and the pH goes down. So while acidification is driven by atmospheric loading is a global issue, it may be worse in areas such as ours that are compounded by other local drivers such as natural upwelling and pollution discharge. And the relative contribution of these remains unclear. It's something we need to tease apart. Why do we care? I hope we do. Ocean chemistry is largely balanced by processes such as atmospheric exchange and the deposition and burial of calcium carbonate on the seafloor. But the rate of change that we're presently experiencing and projected to experience in the near future is unprecedented in geologic history. So while animals and ecosystems have evolved in a relatively stable ocean chemistry, The conjecture is that they won't be able to keep up with the rate of change of the acidification. Research is demonstrating now how seriously lower pH can affect certain marine species, of course, particularly those that form calcium shells and other structures. The rates and the magnitude vary with time and space and depth, and the impacts are uncertain and not going to be even across the spectrum. Some species may acclimate or adapt, though again, research is suggesting that this issue may lead to local extinctions. And of critical importance, and I care about this a lot, is that there's concern that ocean acidification is yet another impact where species and ecosystems are already stressed by pollution, changing temperatures, hypoxia, and extraction. So understanding how these multiple stressors or cumulative impacts affect a system is an emerging science that can guide our future planning and permitting decisions. From an economic perspective, we're in agreement that California's oceans are important to our economy. But more specifically, the shellfish industry is beginning to suffer some deleterious effects from acidification. So what's being done? What can we do? In recognition of the potential harmful impacts of acidification on our ecosystems and economy, many states and the federal government is asking scientists to respond to decision makers' questions on the subject. And we've all heard that in Washington state, an executive order from Governor Gregoire convened a team of experts and stakeholders to address this issue, and their final reports are due out in a month or so, and California stands to benefit a great deal from that effort, and we want to thank them for that. To be clear, California has not been absent from addressing this issue, and I've mentioned this in previous OPC meetings. The California Current Acidification Network, or CCAN, is a grassroots group of scientists, fishermen, shellfish growers, and the ocean observing community. And we've been meeting to advance our understanding of this very complex issue collectively. In August, we met in San Diego to come to an agreement on fundamental issues, which is, begin with simply how do we measure ocean acidification? And I'm aware that the California Water Board has been working directly with scientists to help us understand some of the most fundamental pieces of this that we need in order to advance our understanding and think about management options. California scientists have sensors in the water from which we're all going to benefit. And I just want to say again that the community that's come together around this issue has been breathtakingly generous in sharing data, sharing lessons learned, working collaboratively and not competitively. So yes, there are sensors in the water that are serving NOAA, that will serve the Water Board, that are going to those data will become publicly available for everybody to pile on and learn from. And this is really a spectacular all hands on deck effort. And I am deeply grateful for everybody's generosity in that. Yet, our California decision makers have questions that need to be addressed now, and our intention today with the staff recommendation is to provide a venue that can thoughtfully and authoritatively address resource managers' questions. And, not unlike what we're going to hear with the Sea Level Rise Task Force, we oil up your science advisory team and help them help us, and we will use them to identify who the best experts are and what the process will be so that we can address questions in real time. And finally, to be clear, we're all sensitive to the fact that as scientists, we do not have the luxury to watch this play out over the next several decades. And we want to work together now to support our decision makers as our scientific understanding of this issue unfolds. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have three requests to speak on this, and I'm going to make a comment and then call on them. The first one, Steve Weisberg, if he wants to get ready. And I was just going to say two things. First, the recommended action, so people know, is consideration and possible council direction to the science advisor to assess the scientific understanding of ocean acidification, work with state resource managers to identify key management questions, and report findings to the council at a future meeting. And I wanted to say one of the reasons I asked for this to be here is in part, if any of you have heard Zeke Grader speak on certain issues, he says basically that, yes, he's generally okay with the direction to protect marine areas and do the MLPA, but that's not the whole story. The whole story is many other things, and people should be working on it, on all those other issues as well. And I really have taken that to heart. This is one of them, and I think there's an incredible amount of education to do, because I don't think people make the link clearly that what we do on emissions and climate change directly affects the ocean and acidification. It's not things that directly are with the ocean. This is one that's there and with the air, and we have to draw that connection for people so they understand it, and I think that's part of what we'll do, and that's part of what the suite is of different actions so that we respond, I think, to Zeke's concern, but that's what we should be doing and have been doing as the Ocean Protection Council as well. So with that as just an introductory comment, I'll call on Steve Weisberg, and then Caitlin Gaffney is on deck.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Steve Weisberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project Authority. I'm also a member of your OPC Science Advisory Team. I'm here to speak in support and endorse the proposed action. The ocean acidification issue in front of you is one that's real. It's one that is already affecting the behavior of the shellfish industry, as they're finding that they need to monitor the water to figure out what are the right times to take the water into their hatchery or what are the right times to put the spat back out into the water, because the acidification has reached a point where it is affecting the biota, it's affecting the industry. I'm also here to tell you that the science advisory team is well poised to address this. It is an issue that we are all very cognizant of and very enthusiastic to help provide you the information that will shape the management directions that you're going to take on this. With that endorsement, though, I'd like to encourage you to maybe think a tiny bit broader in the charge, recognizing that there's a linkage between these high carbon dioxide waters that are acidified and low oxygen waters. Essentially, the same thing that leads to high CO2 leads to low oxygen in those waters. And those are the waters that are in the deeper areas that are sloshing up onto the coast and causing the problem. And I think the more that you can provide that linkage and look at the low oxygen in the waters at the same time you're looking at acidification would be in your best interest, because it's those are, as you say, in a kind of a cumulative way affecting the biota. So with that, I endorse your action and look forward to working with you on it.
Thank you very much. Next is Caitlin Gaffney, and on deck is Sean Bothwell.
Good morning, Caitlin Gaffney with Ocean Conservancy. We did submit a written letter of support. I have copies here just in case you don't have them in front of you, but just wanted to reiterate our support for this action as well. We think it makes a lot of sense to have the Ocean Protection Council and the Ocean Science Trust taking a really hard look at this incredibly important issue of ocean acidification and its implications for the state of California. I'd also like to make a link with the next item on your agenda, which is about working regionally on ocean observing. So obviously, the Ocean Science Trust and Ocean Protection Council are already doing this, but just tie those two things together. Of course, this is a huge issue for California, but also for our neighbors, Oregon and Washington, and it really makes sense to be looking at these issues regionally. As Skyly mentioned, the Washington State has had a panel underway for the last several months looking at this issue. Let's learn from them. Let's figure out what California can add, but let's tackle this collaboratively. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sean Bothwell.
Good morning. My name is Sean Bothwell. I'm the staff attorney for the California Coastkeeper Alliance, which represents 12 waterkeepers statewide. On behalf of the Alliance, we strongly support the Ocean Protection Council resolution directing the OPC Science Advisor to assess current scientific understanding of ocean acidification and the work with state resource managers to identify key management questions and reports findings to this council. The California Coastkeeper Alliance has been working closely with OPC and other agency staff over the past 2 years to prompt interagency work to address ocean acidification, including work with OPC staff to identify goals and potential actions on ocean acidification for inclusion in OPC's 2012 strategic plan. This resolution is a critical step to the council action on ocean acidification. During the implementation of this resolution, we urge close coordination and work with state and regional water boards. In most coastal regions, data is not readily available to characterize short-term marine pH variability or to provide the baseline necessary to identify long-term trends. In California, with the exception of pH, there are no water quality objectives for ocean acidification parameters, and therefore the Water Board does not actively monitor for such parameters. The Water Board's immediate involvement in this effort is essential to ensure that ongoing data collection and monitoring efforts can inform effective policy processes, including the development of impaired waterways under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act and amendments and updates to the Ocean Plan. The Council's adoption of this resolution is a critical step to moving forward in ocean acidification impacts in California. However, we feel the time is ripe for the Ocean Protection Council to go a step further and to create an ocean acidification panel, like which was talked about earlier, the State of Washington's Ocean Acidification Blue Ribbon Panel. This month, that panel will preliminarily approve a final report, recommendations, and communication strategy for their state on ocean acidification. Initial research and data indicate that ocean acidification impacts will be massive along the western coast. California depends heavily on our ocean ecosystem, and thus we urge OPC to not delay the creation of an ocean acidification panel here in California so that we can continue to be a leading voice on marine and coastal issues. We look forward to continued work with OPC, the State Water Board, and other partners to assess ocean acidification and mitigate climate change impacts to our state's economy and the environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now the matter's back before the council for any comments or action. Kat.
Just in terms of what Mr. Weisberg said, I think we would endorse the idea of amending the draft resolution before the council to include low oxygen.
Okay.
And I could read the whole thing to you when you're ready.
I think by reference we will do that. Other questions or comments? Yes.
Do we have any, other than Tomales Bay oyster farming, is there a shellfish industry in California beyond that?
I think that's the only one. But to be clear, we have wild catch fisheries that are susceptible to this. We've got urchin fisheries and so forth. So it's not just the growers, but it's the wild catch fishers who are at risk as well. And Kat's reminding me that there's initial permitting for an offshore mussel aquaculture, which, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments or questions? Then we will incorporate low oxygen into the recommendation. And I would say, since this is coming back to us just as a fact, we will note all the comments so that we can respond to those and whatever comes back to us. Is there a motion on the recommendation?
So moved.
Motion? Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very much for working on that. Thank you for your comments, members of the public. We'll move to number 5, which is a memorandum of understanding among the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health and West Coast Ocean Observing Systems.
Good morning, Chair Laird, Council members. My name is Valerie Termini McCormick, and I'm a project manager with Ocean Protection Council. I'm addressing the MOU between the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health and the West Coast Ocean Observing Systems. As many of you know, the West Coast Governors Alliance, or WCGA, was initiated by the governors of Washington, Oregon, and California as a proactive regional collaboration to protect and manage the ocean coastal resources along the entire West Coast. There are 3 West Coast Ocean Observing Systems, or OOSes: SCOOS, which is in Southern California, SINCOOS, which is in Central California, and NANOOS, the Northwest Association of Networked Ocean Observing Systems. Together, they share responsibility for observing the California Current large marine ecosystem along the entire West Coast. The West Coast Governors Alliance and the OOSes have a number of shared priorities, as we just heard about: ocean acidification, harmful algal blooms, and surface current mapping, just to be a few of them, that are better addressed by a regional effort. This MOU will help ensure that future monitoring and data products will be compatible and interoperable throughout the region, will improve communication, planning, and data sharing. By working together, we will save time, resources, and will position both groups to better protect and respond to ocean and coastal issues more effectively. This enhanced coordination will help avoid redundancy and conflicts and ensure the states and the OOS activities are complementary with one another. Under the MOU, the West Coast Governors Alliance and the West Coast OOSes agree to collaborate on the following. First, every other year, the organizations will establish regional priorities. The organizations will then promote these priorities in work plans, fund development, and in communications. Second, the organizations will share committee and working group meeting materials. Third, the organizations will jointly support projects of mutual interest and will share the outcomes and deliverables of these projects. And lastly, the organizations will report to their respective leaders on progress with the MOU and will solicit suggestions for emerging priorities as well as other collaboration opportunities. The duration of the agreement will be for 2 years unless it's canceled, but renewal will be automatic. And recently, our Skylie McAfee was elected to serve on SYNCOOS's 15-member governing body, and she's here to speak on behalf of the Ocean Observing Networks in this MOU. Skylie.
Thank you very much, Val. So none of the directors of the three RAs could be here today, and they regret that they haven't been able to. So they just asked me to obviously, in my new capacity as a board member, to support this. And also to suggest that this is not an administrative act that they're requesting, but rather this is a gesture that will help them save money and work more efficiently together, and it demonstrates that they're proactive in collaboration, that as we talked about with hypoxia and OA is the approach that we're all going to need to take as these pressures on our oceans amount. So on their behalf, I'm supportive of this action.
Thank you. And we have one request to speak on this, Lilo Monroe from NRDC.
Thank you, Council Members. Lilo Monroe with NRDC. I just want to very briefly state our support for this MOU. It includes specific action items which will facilitate California and the Ocean Protection Council's coordination and leadership with the West Coast Governors Alliance, which is a very valuable effort, but really only as good as the participation of the three states. So it's excellent to see some specific actions that will be undertaken as part of the work with the alliance. And then very generally, I'd just like to say, to offer my compliments to Executive Director Coleman and the Council for crafting a very well-rounded agenda. I think in light of very limited resources, you have targeted very strategically some of the key issues that our organization feels are most critical to address. And so I didn't speak on the previous action item, but ocean acidification as well is something we certainly are very concerned about and appreciate the prioritization of that work. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the matter's back to us for questions, comments, or action. Seeing no questions or comments, is there any action on this? Matt.
Well, I think it's a good idea to work collaboratively with other states along the Pacific Coast, and so I'm in favor of doing this. I think the only suggestion I would have is that we do need to notify the governor's office that I'm almost reticent to enter into MOUs without, on behalf of the state purportedly without checking with the chief administrator and executive officer, but I'm fine with the idea that we would be directing the chair to go ahead and sign this subject to checking in with the governor's office. I think that'd be the right way to proceed.
And I will offer my apologies as the newbie who just skipped a beat there. Apologies.
That's okay. You just heard from the one attorney on the council.
old habits die hard. But with that modification, I'd like to move the recommendation. And let me ask a question. There's also a reference.
And let me just say, is there a second to that motion?
Second
by Gordon.
Thank you. With that, let me also observe that the staff is further recommending that we adopt some findings here. Should we incorporate that into the action of council here?
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Then that would be part of the motion as well.
That's the way the seconder told me. That was the reason why he seconded the motion.
Okay.
So we're there on that.
I'm glad we got it.
And I would like to welcome Geraldine Natz to the meeting. Thank you. We already announced that the air travel system was the result of you not being here, not anything of your doing. So we'll move to a vote. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries. We'll move to item number 6, sea level rise, a report on the recently released National Academy of Sciences report.
Thank you, Chair Laird and members of the council. My name is Amy Vieira. I'm a policy analyst with the Natural Resources Agency. And before I introduce Dr. Kahan more formally, I wanted to provide a little bit more context. In 2008, Governor Schwarzenegger issued an executive order which called for a study by the Natural Research Council to develop sea level rise projections specific to the California coast. Prior to this time, the global sea level rise projections that were used in California did not take into consideration important factors that affected sea level rise projections specific to our region. Issues such as atmospheric circulation patterns in the Pacific and tectonic activity. Furthermore, the global projections that were used at the time, which were developed by the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their third and fourth assessment, were generally acknowledged to be conservative. They did not take into account some very important factors. So as the state began to scope out the work for this project, the states of Oregon and Washington and three federal agencies, NOAA, U.S. Geological Survey, and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, expressed their desire to participate in the study as well. And I just wanted to mention that this collaborative partnership was really fostered by the fact that the staff from the three states and federal agencies were already working together under the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health. And I wanted to pause for just a quick moment to thank Janine Jones and John Andrew of DWR who managed this grant. It was no small matter to manage all the contracting between the three states and three federal agencies, as I'm sure you can imagine. So recognizing that it would take some time for the NRC to complete its work, an interim sea level rise guidance document was developed to inform and assist state agencies as they developed approaches for incorporating sea level rise into their planning. This interim sea level rise guidance document was developed by a subset of the 16 state agency member Coastal and Ocean Working Group of the California Climate Action Team, or COCAT, which has been led by the OPC. The COCAT worked with a committee of climate change experts from the OPC Science Advisory Team, including Dr. Kahan, who responded to technical or scientific questions in helping to develop these projected sea level rise estimates. Shortly after the COCAT finished the development of the interim sea level rise guidance document, this body, the OPC, passed a resolution in March 2011 supporting state agencies' use of these projections. Secretary Laird, as chair of the OPC, then sent a letter to 47 state agencies encouraging them to use the interim sea level rise guidance document. And I'm very gratified to report to you that there's several agencies that have used this guidance document. I'll mention just a few. One of them is the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission. About 1 year ago, they amended their Bay Plan to consider climate change impacts, including sea level rise, in their permitting decisions. The Coastal Commission intends to bring a policy guidance document to their commission within the next several months. And within the existing authority given to them under the Coastal Act, they have been considering sea level rise and have been using the interim sea level rise guidance numbers. Both the Strategic Growth Council and the State Coastal Conservancy have integrated this document into their funding criteria. And so, again, all of these specific entities specifically reference the interim sea level rise guidance document. So now we're at the point where the NRC study has been completed, and the COCAD intends to go back and work with the OPC Science Advisory Team to revise this sea level rise guidance document according to the results of the study. Let me now introduce our speaker. Dr. Dan Kahn is a researcher with both the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego and U.S. Geological Survey, and he's going to discuss the results of the study. Dr. Kahn received an undergraduate degree in meteorology and oceanography from the University of Michigan and a PhD in oceanography from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, UC San Diego. Since 2003, Dr. Kahn has served as the director of the California Climate Change Center at Scripps. This is an institute that's sponsored by the California Energy Commission. And I just wanted to note, we're really fortunate in California to have some of the top scientists working on sea level rise issues. Both Dr. Kahn and Dr. Gary Griggs from UC Santa Cruz, who has presented to you in the past, are on the OPC Science Advisory Team. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Kahn.
Thank you, Amy.
Good morning.
Good to see you, Council and Chairman Laird. I'm going to just give you a few highlights. I've been warned about your the virtues of being brief, so this will be a skim.
If this is being broadcast to Santa Cruz, I hope everybody was just listening to that.
Okay. I know there's some in-jokes going on there. What I'd like to say is that I'm representing a committee of 13 members chaired by Tony Dalrymple, whose name is on the slide. The membership was broad. This was a multidisciplinary group, and I think we all learned a lot about nuances and aspects of sea level rise that many of us were unaware of, so it was an interesting exercise. As Amy mentioned, this was instigated by a California governor's executive order, and the study had a lifetime of a year and a half or so. So this was fairly involved. There's a rather large document that is available from the National Research Council, which can be downloaded. We in California are not unfamiliar with coastal water level problems. Many of us will remember 1983 and other magnificent coastal events here. Sea level rise, of course, is a process which will exacerbate what we are already accustomed to from time to time. Historically, I don't know if I can get this to operate real well, but we have seen sea level rise along the California coast to the tune of a little more than half a foot in the last century for areas San Francisco and southward. By and large, I guess we probably say that our systems have been able to adapt. In the future, as climate warms, which it very certainly will, we already heard about acidification, the pace of change will accelerate. Schematically, that's what's shown here. Of course, there's a broad range of futures owing to the uncertainty of the science and the uncertainty of humans in controlling their emissions of greenhouse gases and the consequent warming of the planet.
But suffice it to say that it's quite likely that sea level rise will increase by at least twofold, if not by eightfold, relative to what we've seen over the last century. So that half a foot of sea level rise turns into at least a foot, if not 5 or 6 feet, if we're unlucky. Amy laid out the seeds of the study. I guess all I would say is that we were scoped with both global and regional elements in projecting sea level rise along the West Coast. As was mentioned, this grew to be a California, Oregon, Washington study. And the regional elements, including storminess and wetlands, as well as sea level rise itself. The geographic and geologic setting here along the West Coast comes into play, and it turns out that the boundary here in Northern California between the San Andreas system, which is largely a system where plates are moving laterally and not so much vertically, and the area to the north, which is the so-called Cascadia fault zone, where land is actually rising because of the subsiding Pacific plate, caused a delineation in the estimates that the committee came up with. So we considered north and south of Cape Mendocino in breaking sea level rise into this different two regimes. The other thing that I should mention is that unlike the interim guidance which was provided, which was essentially a bulk estimate of sea level rise for California, the committee took the approach to try to estimate each individual component that contributed to sea level rise, and then considered the resulting sum of those components in its estimate. So the study was involved in that way. This is pretty much the summary slide of the results. And in our charge, we were asked to look at sea level rise at three different points in time along the 21st century trajectory. 2030, which is the top range of projections there, on our picture. Let me just go back 1 second before I do that. Well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to achieve that. Let's just be happy. Just go one flip back. Oh, thank you, Bob. So 2030, which is this set of estimates, 2050, the middle set, and 2100, which is the bottom set, and along the x-axis here is laid out numerical values of sea level rise from 0 to well over 1 meter relative to the year 2000. Okay, so let's go one forward, and I think I'm competent to do that. The estimates that are delineated by the rectangles are the interim guidance that was provided and was discussed previously. The other three are the committee's estimates for the globe. That's the red bar here. The orange is the southern part of the domain, that is California south of Mendocino, and the blue is the northern part of the domain, that is north of that point. By 2030, just to sort of cut to the chase here, it looks like we can expect something in the neighborhood of the amount of sea level rise that we've already seen in the 20th century. So something akin to about a half a foot by the first part of the century. Now, regional details and so forth, and that's something that we probably don't have a lot of time to discuss. By 2050, we can expect round about a foot of sea level rise, again, over this reference point at 2000. And what you notice is that as we move farther out in time, the width of the uncertainty, the width of these bars, grows. Of course, our knowledge gets thinner as we get farther out in time. By 2100, of course, there's a pretty broad range of estimates, but a round number is 3 feet of sea level rise for the area south of Mendocino and 2 feet of sea level rise to the north. What you notice is that particularly during the earlier part of the century, the committee guidance is quite consistent with that from the interim guidance, which was provided by a different methodology. By the end of the century, they're still broadly consistent, but suffice it to say that the committee numbers were not as large as the previous interim guidance, or the existing interim guidance, I guess I should say, since that's up for discussion. I just mentioned these uncertainties. The regional projections, of course, have somewhat more uncertainty because there's more components to be understood. The large contributors to sea level rise globally, of course, are the thermal expansion of seawater as the oceans warm, and also the melting of land-based ice, particularly Greenland and Antarctica, is another one. And of course, that is a very large source of uncertainty because those observations and that science are still evolving. The uncertainty grows over time, and conversely, we have more confidence at the shorter term than the longer term estimates. So in conclusion, sea level rise to the south, we can expect something in the neighborhood of about 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the present century. To the north, something probably more like 2 feet of sea level rise would hold. There is a game changer that emerged in this study, and that is one that is a result of this tectonic regime that affects the West Coast. So this Cascadia plate is being subducted. It's diving beneath the North American plate north of Mendocino, and occasionally there is a slip and essentially a catastrophe, that by way of an earthquake, a Fukushima class earthquake that there's a record for. There's a sequence of past earthquakes revealed by sediments and drowned forests along the north coast that indicate that such an earthquake would be likely to occur at an interval between 2 to 200 to 700 years. So that would be a game changer that would affect sea level rise by as much as, more than a meter, essentially instantaneously along that stretch of coast. And of course, there would be other effects that would go along with that. So that has to be kept in mind. It's of course unpredictable on the kind of human time scale that most of us are concerned with, but certainly is something that we have to acknowledge. The coastal storm regime was another aspect we were asked to look at, and while it does not look very clear that there will be a profound change in the Pacific storm pattern that we have affecting the West Coast, it is clear that many of our sea level rise problems will be coming into full view during cases where there's the coincidence of a large winter storm, high tides, and of course, oftentimes these are provoked during large El Ninos, 1983, 1998. So that's very much still in our future. Is the strongest effects of sea level rise being coming to a point during storm sequences. The other thing we were asked to look at was the effect of wetlands. Wetlands are crucial in ameliorating sea level rise effects in certain areas, and it does look that up until about mid-century, there's a likelihood that wetlands, there's a process going on there, a competition between the water rising and the sediment and the wetland itself, essentially keeping up with rising seas. And that may well be achieved until about mid-century, but beyond that, as sea level rise accelerates, it could be difficult for wetlands to keep pace. So with that, I should turn it back over to my colleague. And
just before you do, let me ask if there are any questions before he.
Well, that was not exactly optimistic, but my question comes from working at the Capitol, where these kinds of reports get used and often misused. And I'm anticipating someone raising the following argument, that the greater range of sea level rise that is used in the NRC report is an argument for not taking any action on sea level rise, or not engaging in planning or other activities either at the state level or at the level of local governments on the coast. Is that a interpretation that you would agree with?
Well, I could give you a rejoinder, and that would be that yes, there is a range, and I think it, you know, in our view, it represents the state of the science. But if you look at the projections, they're going in one direction. They're not going in both directions. There's not a projection there that says that sea level is going to fall. Secondly, the projections are greater than those from the IPCC reports of the last two generations. So like farming, life is not certain along the coast, but that doesn't mean that farmers don't go out and make decisions and actually conduct long-term exercises that are for their well-being. It doesn't mean that, I think many of us don't know exactly when we're going to retire, but that doesn't mean that we don't keep an eye on our benefits and so forth. So there's a number of sort of common sense approaches that one takes, even though there is this element of uncertainty. Again, the Earth is warming. You just heard a lecture by Skiley as to how the loading of greenhouse gases is affecting the pH of the ocean, and it's very likely that the level of the ocean is going to rise, albeit, we have some surprises in store for us, I'm sure of that. But we basically know what direction it's heading, and we know that magnitudes will likely be much greater than we've seen historically. Long-winded answer, but I think there's a number of arguments that can be marshaled to counter that point of view.
Yes, Geraldine.
Can I add to that? Is the difference between the IPCC and the NRC the way glacier melting is incorporated? Someone had told me that some of the early projections did not include the glacier melt issue.
Yeah, that's one major distinction, mm-hmm. is that the IPCC felt, the IPCC is bound by results that have been published in the literature at the time that the exercise begins. And so this is a very rapidly evolving science. We were not exclusively bound by that. We had members of the committee that were experts in this area, and they took their best shot at ice melt. So that's a big distinction. There's another methodology which doesn't actually directly confront ice melt. That was used in the interim guidance, and that essentially essentially matches the rate of sea level rise with the rate of temperature rise around the globe. And what you see there is that these different methodologies, interestingly enough, even though they have broad uncertainties, are roughly consistent. So, for what that's worth. Amy had something to say about
I just wanted to add a little bit more information to Mr. Craven's question. So I think we have kind of two policy documents that are helping to provide a little bit more guidance, recognizing the fact that these ranges are quite large. In the interim sea level rise guidance document, it talks about using a risk tolerance approach. So in planning, there's definitely a difference between if someone is building a decomposed granite public access trail that, may be in a future vulnerable area, than building a hospital in a vulnerable area. And so the sea level rise guidance document talks about using a risk tolerance approach. I also wanted to mention in the 2011 OPC resolution, there is a clause within there that where the OPC recommends that state agencies and actually any agency receiving funds from the state of California or doing work on granted lands from the legislature not use sea level rise projections within the bottom third of any time period. So we've definitely tried to incorporate some precautionary principles into the policy guidance.
Thank you. Just one quick factual question. You mentioned that north of Cape Mendocino there's a different regime, and you mentioned that the historical pattern is every 200 to 700 years there's a quake of 8.0 or more. When was the last one?
I didn't say 8.0 or more, but...
Well, that's what the chart said. Sorry. Maybe you didn't own the chart.
Yeah. I used Tony's graphic. But, yeah, roughly that's the case. And the last quake that appears in that sequence is around about 1700. So we've been a little more than 300 years into the buildup for the next one.
Okay. Thank you, because that's very significant.
Yeah, Amy? May I just wrap up with a little bit of additional information? So I just wanted to reiterate again that now that the NRC study is complete, we as staff intend to go back and work with the COCAT to revise the what will now be not the interim, but the sea level rise guidance document. From the very beginning, we've envisioned this document to be something that needed to be modified periodically. As Dr. Kahan said, this is a rapidly evolving field of study. And then lastly, I just wanted to mention that the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health, their climate change work group received funding from a private foundation to hold workshops to disseminate the information from the NRC report. The California workshop is going to be held October 26th in San Francisco, a location to be determined. Washington and Oregon are also working on their own workshop. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have one request to speak on this item. It's Richard Sadowski. And he indicates in his form that he's representing his grandson.
Yeah, my grandson's in preschool today. He's 4 years old. Congratulations on the World Futures Council nomination. That's awesome. The Cali OPC going global. And I also would like to thank Kat. I had sent several bits of information to her and haven't responded. Thank you. Regarding the sea level rise document, let me first tell you a little background. One of the major concerns that I have regarding a lot of these estimates is that there's too many variables to get any kind of accurate actions. And one of the variables that we have here is our coastal communities are right now have a huge problem with infrastructure. And the infrastructure I'm talking about is below ground where you don't see it. You flush your toilet, take a shower, and it goes away. I'm a certified wastewater collection system operator and been working on this issue over here in Morro Bay for about 8 years. And to this day, this sea level rise issue and ocean acidification has been ignored on the local level. And in 2003, we had a San Simeon earthquake where I, along with a fellow employee, we surveyed several miles of the infrastructure and were able to get FEMA and OES funding for damages that occurred. And currently, any infrastructure, like a wastewater treatment plant, you mentioned a hospital, but I think the wastewater collection system, infrastructure, treatment plants, they need to be moved off the beach. They need to be moved inland. And water reclamation should be one of the primary things to take care of. And especially, we're looking at the 40th anniversary for the Clean Water Act, and I think this would be a good opportunity to have the OPC look into that matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just maybe a comment in closing. The state government basically, through executive order, gives the Environmental Protection Agency responsibility for dealing with emissions and trying to change emissions. It gives the Resources Agency the responsibility for dealing with adaptation. And as I'm fond of saying, Al Gore did a great job in educating the general public about emissions, but that same level of education hasn't happened on the adaptation side. And the Ocean Protection Council's done an amazing job thus far on sea level rise in trying to let people know what it means, but it really is the
institutionalization of this by individuals along the coast and local governments along the coast to understand exactly what it means. If you have a gravity flow water system that's attuned to sea level, or gravity flow sewer system attuned to sea level, or even when I visited the boardwalk 6 weeks ago, because they're very concerned about the river rerouting, not understanding that the sea is more likely to get into their basement sooner by what is happening. That those are the things that we really have to do. It's a challenge and it's a charge to us to educate people and get them to start making their individual decisions with this in mind, because as was said, there is a measure of uncertainty, but there is certainty that this is happening, and it aligns remarkably given the different ways that people got to estimating the uncertainty and trying to manage it. So I really appreciate this being on our agenda, and we will keep it up from the Ocean Protection Council and trying to make sure Californians prepare and are aware to adapt to sea level rise. Any other comments before we move to the next item? Seeing none, we'll move to item number 7, which is marine life protected areas. And I know we have 3 people. Kat, would you like to introduce this?
Yes, I would like to introduce to the council Sankey Mastrup, who will be speaking on the behalf. As you know, Sankey's the executive director for the Fish and Game Commission, and then he'll be followed by Claire O'Reilly of the OPC staff, and then Ken Wiseman, who's the executive director for the MLPA Enterprise. MLPA Initiative.
Good morning, Chairman Laird, Council. As you heard, my name is Sankey Mastrup. I'm the executive director of the Fish and Game Commission. And I'm pleased to announce that we've accomplished the mission to design and create a network of MPAs along the California coast in law. This statewide network of MPAs is the first of its kind in the United States. This was accomplished through an unprecedented public planning process. California owes the success of this effort through the generous commitment and dedication of Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Game Commission staff, the MLPA Initiative, the Native American tribes, numerous other NGOs, and the public. We have much work ahead of us as we implement the design of this network, and the Commission looks forward to sharing the fruits of this work through periodic reviews, including the first one for the Central Coast Study Region in February of 2013 in Monterey. And with that, if you have any questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Why don't we go through all 3, and then if anybody has any questions, and we have 4 speakers
as well. Thank you, Sankey. Good morning, Council and Chair. My name is Claire O'Reilly. I'm the project manager with the Ocean Protection Council working on MLPA initiatives, and I'd like to provide you with a brief overview of how the Ocean Protection Council has helped implement the Marine Life Protection Act. As Kat touched on this morning, the Ocean Protection Council has provided significant funds that have mainly focused on collecting data and conducting monitoring in the marine protected areas. I'd like to highlight that the Ocean Protection Council's contribution has been substantially leveraged by our partners' resources in the form of matching funds and in-kind services, both from the Marine Life Protection Act Initiative and for these data collection efforts. So some highlights from our partnerships. I'll start with the California Seafloor Mapping Program, which provided accurate seafloor habitat maps that were used in MPA planning. The California Seafloor Mapping Program collected new information about the relief of the seafloor and geology and habitat types, and this information will continue to inform evaluations of marine protected area ecosystem health, as well as other ocean resource management challenges. The OPC led this partnership with state and federal agencies, academic institutions, and the private industry, and I'd like to highlight that the last piece of data for this program was collected a couple of weeks ago, and we're really excited about moving forward with getting this data out and useful. The OPC also partnered with the Department of Fish and Game by providing funds for department staff to participate in the planning process, as well as collect necessary information for MPA planning and monitoring. These funds went towards the initial baseline monitoring of the Central Coast Marine Protected Areas and improved methods for collecting fisheries data, as well as equipment improvements that allow the department to collect other important physical and biological data. The OPC has also granted funds to the California Ocean Science Trust for the creation of a statewide monitoring program now known as the MPA Monitoring Enterprise. The activities of the monitoring enterprise include development and implementation of scientifically rigorous and cost-effective MPA monitoring, as well as the analysis and distribution of this monitoring data and communicating results and findings to agencies, decision makers, key stakeholders, and the general public. The monitoring enterprise plays a key role in each of the regional baseline monitoring programs. The Ocean Protection Council authorized funding for these regional baseline monitoring programs in 2008. The objectives of the baseline programs are to assess ecological and socioeconomic conditions near the time of MPA adoption, as well as to measure initial ecological changes and impacts to user groups as a result of the MPAs being in place. The baseline programs are led by a team composed of the Monitoring Enterprise, the Department of Fish and Game, California Sea Grant, and staff from the Ocean Protection Council. This collaboration leverages significant resources from the projects that are selected to be part of these programs, as well as other outside entities. So in conclusion, the OPC and our partners have supported science-based implementation of the statewide network of MPAs, and this partnership will continue to inform other ocean resource management challenges. I'd like to now turn it over to Ken Wiseman, who will talk more about these partner contributions as well as next steps.
Thank you and good morning. 6 years ago when I started as the executive director of the initiative, when I said I was with an initiative, people often thought I was collecting signatures for a ballot initiative. And so that continues to be, I think, some confusion about just what is the initiative and where it has been and where it's going. And I think Sankey and I had talked yesterday about how can we explain that, and it would be like these four parts of the coast that were divided up and are in different places. It's like having four different children in school at different ages, and you're trying to get them all through and work at the planning start get to college part. And so obviously we've succeeded in that we have them in law, and now we have to figure out how we can really truly implement and bring them together in the best way possible. My position, as you may remember, is funded by a coalition of foundations, and I'm in the office of the secretary, have been for 6 years, and we have been able to do some amazing things because we have five foundations that have put up $20 million. And they are part of that chart, Bobby, the one that was just back up. The $75 million includes about a little over $20 million from the foundations. And there's about $20 million in there from the Fish and Game Department over the last 8 years. The foundations have pledged another $20 million for the next 5 years to make sure that the job gets done. So that number is really going to be 95 in 5 years. And working with the secretary as to how we spend that money and hoping that less of it is in implementation and more of it is in monitoring, but kind of depending on what happens in November, we will be there to make sure that this program continues to flourish. And so that's very exciting from our standpoint. And what's come from this, too, is a phenomenal opportunity for collaboration. And this started with an MOU between the Department of Fish and Game, the Resources Agency, and the Foundation. We now have an MOU where we have almost all the major state and federal agencies working together and talking about opportunities. And from that have come great opportunities with EPA and Resources getting together on tribal issues and such things as that continue to be a positive outgrowth of the MLPA initiative. And the seafloor mapping is another example. That $15 million was, as Claire said, just not for MLPA. That's been huge as far as informing. That money came from the federal government. They're using those maps for all kinds of things, as are different state and local agencies. And we continue to see that kind of investment pay off, and especially in the science and the monitoring as we gather this information and we figure out how to get it and share it. It's huge, and the OPC has been the initiator of that, and now in this memorandum of understanding is the coordinator. Your executive director gets to make all this work together. And so that's also, it's challenging, but it's been a great opportunity. And it's especially for me to have Kat here now, her coming from the water board with another agency and a perspective. Immediately, the collaboration just notches up because it's about including everybody as much as possible. So that's been a very positive. So we go to the next slide, Bobby. And as I said, the family, our last child was born on the North Coast this past year, and is supposed to get into grammar school about the first of the year. Our oldest child on the Central Coast.
This is figurative. Right?
Figuratively, yes. Thank you.
Just yeah, checking. Yeah, right. Yeah.
No, I'm.
You're married to a federal judge, and this was all news to me. Yeah.
thank you. Anyway, and we only have two children, right? And they're both out of college, so I'm really glad about that. But as we. The North Coast is just starting, and but we have finished in the Central Coast, and as Claire alluded, in February we're going to have looking to the opportunity to figure out where we have been in these 5 years, and continue the monitoring programs in the South Coast, and all these are opportunities to just figure out how we can best govern and partner. And one of the things is that I put up there that started out as what probably one of our biggest challenges and has been one of our greatest victories. Is our relationship with the tribes and tribal communities. On the North Coast, where that's a very, you know, very much a presence and an issue of concern, we were able, I think, to take a lot of time and blood, sweat, and tears and turn it into a positive. And we have a relationship now that I think both the tribal community and the regulatory community didn't ever think would be possible. And I thank both Secretary Laird in his promoting that and being insistent on it, and Secretary Rodriguez in another life when he was an attorney general and gave us information that said, yes, you can. And so that is just probably one of our greatest victories. And it's, again, it gets back to this collaboration and the last point here, collaboration being driven by good data, good science. And I know the Secretary and I have both had the pleasure of going to the Ocean Science Trust meetings and just seeing the energy of when you bring together our science advisory team, people like Dr. Weisberg and others who are just looking for the kind of information to give us the best that they can, what they know, what they don't know, and just really inform your decision making. And this is really a key role for the Ocean Protection Council, and you're at the nexus. And it's I think it's very exciting for the next 5 years. And whatever may happen in our fiscal craziness, we have five foundations who are saying we're going to be there with you. We want you to collaborate with your MOU, and we want to make sure we finish the job. So we are in a good position.
Thank you very much. I think before we do questions, I have a request for five speakers, and why don't we hear from them, and then if there are any questions or comments, that would be appropriate. The first one is Dr. Janine Pfeiffer from Mendocino County, and then on deck is Dan Hamburg.
Thank you, Secretary Laird. And I am here representing Mendocino County, but I'm also a professor at San Jose State University and a teacher at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And my students are watching this because I should be with them right now. And I just wanted to say that our students discussed the evolutionary adaptation that we expect to see given ocean acidification and sea level rise. And they diagrammed it, if anyone's interested in looking at the diagrams. And the 15-year-olds got it. So if they got it, I think all of us can.
And will there be a test? Are they going to be tested on watching this?
Possibly.
Okay. they should be paying attention.
So I want to thank Secretary Laird and everyone for helping to make history in the North Coast Study Region and for celebrating how positive things can happen when we have local experts sitting at the same table. And I want to thank Executive Director Kat Coleman for proposing solutions to the requests contained in a letter that's been signed by all three counties to Secretary Laird, and which we have additional copies I will give to you. And Supervisor Dan Hamburg from Mendocino County is here representing three counties of Boards of Supervisors and also our Fort Bragg City Council. And we do look forward to working together with the Monitoring Enterprise and the Ocean Science Trust to construct the best possible monitoring plan, not just for the next 3 to 5 years, but for the next 30 to 50 years. And I want to thank Skyly McAfee for promising Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Sutton that our collaborative conversation will continue, and also to Liz Whiteman and her team for the time spent in meetings with our North Coast constituents. So when I was working in Indonesia with Bapak Suhirman, the head of the Indonesian Botanic Gardens, he sat me down and he said, Janine, there's a technical component and there's a non-technical component. He says, do you know what I mean by the non-technical component? I said, humans, right. He said, you can get the technical side perfectly, but if you aren't paying attention, equal or more attention to the human aspects, you will either succeed partially or you will fail. So here on the North Coast, we've been anticipating the Monitoring Enterprise for 3 years. We invited ReefCheck to come to our region and give training to our divers. We formed ad hoc committees at the local and the regional level, and we've reached out to scientists. But for us, it's not about the money. It's not about the $4 million. What it is for us is how and why and when and with what resources are we going to research, monitor, and conserve our coastlines long after the Monitor Enterprise is gone. In the past, our region and Mendocino County in particular has been subject to the cash and carry research model, where folks come, very well-intentioned, well-credentialed scientists, many of them are my friends, come into our region, do research, import staff, import equipment, and then export the data and export the knowledge. And what we're asking is, instead of that model, we're asking for a value-added model. And we're asking for seats at the table again. And we're hoping for research where not just folks come in and listen to us and then go back and do things in Sacramento and Oakland, but where we have active collaborations and we're sitting at the same tables together so that we can build local capacity and we can incorporate local expertise throughout this process and again for many years to come. So essentially, I'm asking that we have the type of collaboration that we've never seen before on our coast and to continue the tremendous work that was done with the Monitoring Enterprise. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to move to Dan Hamburg from the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors, and on deck is Layla Monroe from NRDC. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the council. This is the first time I've ever attended a meeting of this council, and I have to say I'm really impressed by the issues that you're taking on. They are huge California, national, international issues, and I'm just very heartened that you're certainly not shying away from them. I am here to speak as a member of the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors. We, as Janine mentioned, we did send a letter to the secretary with copies to several of you on the committee, and if any of you have not seen that letter, we do have extra copies. It was a letter with that really summarizes what Janine Pfeiffer just talked about, and it was passed unanimously by our board, and I also want to emphasize that a very similar letter was also passed unanimously by the Board of Supervisors in Humboldt County, as well as in Del Norte County. So, as well as many of the cities up and down the coast, including Point Arena and Fort Bragg. So, I just say that so that you understand that there is a lot of unanimity of opinion about how we move forward with this next phase of monitoring and information gathering and so on to make these new MPAs really workable and really, to meet the hopes and, what we want to see come forward as a result of the MLPA. It was interesting to hear Mr. Wiseman talk about his four children developing on the California coast, and I guess we would be the unruly child up in our region.
He meant to say that he loves all his children.
I know
equally.
He loves all his children. But, you know, sometimes parents even love the unruly child the most, and I hope he does love us, because we are indeed unruly. As a matter of fact, when I started running for a seat on the board in 2010 and started hearing from my constituents, and I do want to say that I represent the area from the Wallala River, which is where Mendocino and Sonoma County meet, going up just south of Casper. So I have the southernmost part of that North Coast region. And I have to say that what most of the people who eventually voted for me and voted me into office were saying about the MLPAI was not very flattering. People were not happy with the process. They didn't feel that they were being adequately heard. They felt like the fisheries on the North Coast were already tremendously overregulated. I'm sure you all know how decimated our fishing industry has been over the past decades. And people just felt like this was another government intrusion. Not only that, but when we went to appeal to our assemblyman, Wes Chesbro, about this, he said, well, basically, there's nothing I can do. This is a law that was passed over a decade ago. It's being implemented now. So it wasn't even a situation where we felt we could appeal to our elected representatives. This felt like something that was being imposed upon us. And I was really interested that, Secretary Laird, when you started this meeting, you made mention of the North Coast and the tremendous progress that was made over a period of, I would say, about 18 months, where I think the tide really turned from this huge resistance to this whole project to a lot of unanimity around the preferred alternative that was finally voted in by the Fish and Game Commission in Eureka on June the 6th. So we did make a lot of progress. You also mentioned the tribes. Well, what I remember about the tribes is that they were very disenchanted about this process, so much so that on July 20th of 2010, they showed up en masse at a Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting and basically took over the meeting for 4 hours and filibustered the meeting. And they were heard, and they are, I would say, very amenable at this point to what's going on with the Marine Life Protection Act initiative. But it wasn't without a lot of struggle. So I think in the spirit of what Jeanine Pfeiffer, Dr. Pfeiffer, just said, we are hoping to continue what we achieved in reaching the preferred alternative and in coming together. And the way we can best do that is to be in a true and deep partnership with all of the players as we move forward with this next phase. And that's really what we're asking for. And if that comes to fruition, I think this next phase will not have to go through that really rocky period that I think almost really took this process apart on the North Coast. And we can have much smoother sailing and a much more successful process going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Layla Monroe, and on deck is Caitlin Gaffney.
Thank you so much, Council. Layla Monroe from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Really speaking on behalf of my whole team, especially my director, Karen Garrison, and all of NRDC that's been involved with this process from the beginning, we want to thank the Council, the MLPA Initiative, members, staff, the MPA Monitoring Enterprise, leadership and staff, and really all of the stakeholders around the state who have been engaged for so many years in what is recognized nationally and internationally as a really gold medal effort, and the outcomes of that effort are starting to bear fruit. And it's not just the stakeholder engagement, which you've heard about, but also the application of the best science, the innovative public-private partnership that was employed, the interagency coordination that is now ongoing, and actually we're seeing really
excellent opportunities for the agencies to work together to support these cornerstone protected areas. So thank you all so much.
Thank you. So Caitlin Gaffney, and then on deck is Marla Jo Bruton.
Good afternoon. Caitlin Gaffney with Ocean Conservancy. And I wanted to just briefly thank the Ocean Protection Council for all of their support and commitment over these many years to making the Marine Life Protection Act such a success. Ocean Conservancy has been engaged throughout the state. And I would suggest those that think that the North Coast was the unruly child did not participate in the South Coast. My in-laws live in San Diego County, and for several years throughout the Marine Life Protection Act, I would get regular little envelopes in the mail with carefully clipped articles and columns by Ed Zoralski, a sports fishing columnist in the San Diego Union Tribune, voicing his opinions, the Marine Life Protection Act, not one of the strongest supporters. So I was very excited about a week ago to get an envelope in the mail from my mother-in-law in San Diego with a beautiful clipping from Sunset Magazine highlighting California's new underwater parks, and a follow-up call. You know, Caitlin, that project you've been working on, I couldn't help but notice it was in Sunset Magazine. So it was an exciting day for me. I brought copies for you. Thanks again.
Thank you, and thank your in-laws. Marla Jo Bruton's our last speaker.
Good morning, council, staff, and the public. My name is Marla Jo Bruton, and I'm a resident of North Morro Bay. I guess I'd have to say we're the South Central MPA represent here. The MPA, I myself have been involved in the MPA process and coming to these meetings for the past 5 or 6 years, and the amount of work that's been done with the MPAs is just incredible, amazing. And I want to say that in Morro Bay, it's a fishing community. The MPAs weren't received, the ideas weren't received or welcomed by the fishing community. However, by bringing them into the discussion and allowing them to be part of the discussion, things were worked out, and we're happy to report that the past two years of fishing in Morro Bay has been excellent. So there is a direct correlation that we see from the changing the fishing gear and the actions of the MPA. We were lucky enough to our East Bay. Morro Bay is a state marine reserve. We were able to get that put into place, and then also Point Bouchon in our area is a state marine reserve. I'd like to just say that the MPA efforts that have gone on in our area are in many citizens' opinion right now under a full assault by the acoustic sonic testing that's proposed by PG&E. I just want you to know that there is an alliance being formed, and it's growing by leaps and bounds, called COAST, Citizens Opposed to Acoustic Sound Testing. And as of today, that group of people that have been, and groups that have been discussing this matter, do not feel that mitigation is an option. We know that, bureaucratically, mitigation is the only way, the best you could hope for, talking to international cetacean people and what have you, to stop this boat, because it's never been stopped before. But I just want the OPC to be aware that we love our MPAs, and we love our ocean, we love our whales, and we are the citizen and the Indian tribes were not even notified in this PG&E deal. And that, since you're up for a UN award, or we're going global commons here, with the whales and what have you. I'd just like you to know that as the Chumash people in San Luis Obispo County have signed a UN Charter of Indigenous People with the UN, and that in their opinion, the sonic testing, acoustic testing, violates Article 11, 23, and 24 of the UN Charter for Indigenous People. And I know you can't really do anything about it, but I thought that Ocean Protection Council should have a voice from the community, letting you know how a lot of people feel. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments very much, and appreciate the fact that people came from different parts of the state to comment on this item. And maybe to make a couple of, normally we don't necessarily respond to the public comment, but I think people made some very good points and came from long ways, and I want to tell Supervisor Hamburg that there will be a response to the letter, but I think that the real response will be trying to keep the collaborative spirit that emerged from both the designation process and the tribal negotiations going. And in many ways, we're creating some of this as we go along. So we'll need the feedback if it turns out that exactly what Dr. Pfeiffer said starts to happen, of feeling like people are coming in and leaving with information. We'll need that kind of feedback as it goes along, because we are creating this in many ways as we do go along. And I really appreciated Dr. Pfeiffer's comments about not just what you can measure in 3 or 5 years, but 30 or 50, because if you look at this on a scientific basis, if you look at, I think the example I use sometimes is rockfish that have an incredibly long life and amazingly are more fertile in the later stages of life. It's a question of, are we where we should be at 5 years, on our way to where we should be at 10 or 15 or 20 or 25? And if people have the expectation that every fishery revives totally at 5 years, that might not be the biological cycle. That might not be the way it works. And so part of our challenge with our monitoring team is to educate the public and the stakeholders as to what are appropriate benchmarks to look at the right time to see where we really are and where we are getting. And I want to congratulate the people on the North Coast, because it is exactly as Supervisor Hamburg said, and I sort of alluded to at the beginning of the meeting, is that I didn't see a positive outcome in the early part of 2010. And a lot of that positive outcome was done by the stakeholders on the North Coast themselves in really coming together to work with the process to design a map that was a compromise map. And despite the fact that you think Assemblymember Chesbro might not be able to do anything, he's the person that got on the phone on my first full day as secretary to tell me that this tribal issue was going to blow up unless I did something. And I think of my first 7 days as secretary, he was on the phone to me 6 of them. And he said, this will not be happening during your entire term. There will be weeks that go by where I haven't called you. But that's not true right now. And so I think the credit that was given to Secretary Rodriguez is very apt, because I made a commitment to find a way to work it out, and it didn't happen right away. The negotiations actually blew up after 2 months, and we had to press reset and start and not give up. And I did not know the person that became Secretary Rodriguez, but I got to him in the Attorney General's office, and he did something that I had not experienced from an attorney in government in almost 40 years. He said, well, regardless of what the legal stuff is here, what's the right public policy decision? And which was a stunning moment. And I told him it was working this out in a way that some historic takes could be protected, so that we could move ahead with the process with everybody feeling included. And he really gave advice that gave us a path to do that. And then we worked hard to negotiate and walk down that path. So we are really committed in that spirit that got us to this point sort of inclusion with the tribes and recognizing that compromise to want to continue it and make use of it in the monitoring phase. It's just that we might at times, just as an attorney might not usually say, what's the best public policy thing, a scientist might not have been trained in public relations. And so we will work to try to make sure that we do this in the same collaborative, inclusive way that sort of brought us success in the North Coast. And I'm confident we can do it, but I'm just hoping that the trust that we built is trust enough that when people think it appears to be going sideways to them, they will come right to us and we will try to work that out, because hopefully that's been the track record the last year and a half, is that commitment to do that, and we want to keep doing that. So I really appreciate just the progress we've made overall and the comments that were made today and the fact that people traveled long distances to give them to us. Are there any other comments that anybody would like to make? Yes, Geraldine.
I just want to tell the staff that I think finishing the seafloor mapping is a major accomplishment. And when I read the staff report and it talked about, you know, all the money that was leveraged for this overall program, I was wondering, okay, how much? And so I appreciate the information in the slide, because that in itself is a great story, where we've leveraged $44 million to $75 million. I think that adds to the stature of the OPC and the general public. You know, I think the fact that we're leveraging the public money with private sources is a story that should be part of what we tell our story. And so I don't even know the five foundations that are involved. They're not in the staff report, but it might be nice to be more public about that kind of information.
Great, noted. We will do that any time in the future. Other comments before we move on? Well, then, thanks to everybody that participated in that process and the item. We're very grateful. We will move to item number 8, which is Japanese Tsunami Marine Debris Response. Kat.
I'll lead Sarah Flores from OPC. Will lead the charge. She's put together a panel to talk about the response to Japanese tsunami debris, and I'll let you take it from there, Sarah.
Thank you, Kat. Hi, everybody. My name is, Chair Laird and council members. My name is Sarah Flores, and I am a project manager for the Ocean Protection Council. And today I've put together the item for the response to the tsunami debris, as well as discussion on regional marine debris efforts. So I just want to provide a little bit of background for this. On March 11th of last year, a 9.0 magnitude earthquake off of the coast of Japan prompted a devastating tsunami wave. The governor of Japan estimates that 5 million tons of marine debris were generated, and that 70% of this marine debris sank offshore, meaning that 1.5 million tons of marine debris are currently making their way across the Pacific to our shores. As big as this number seems, it pales in comparison with what we annually put out into the oceans. We estimate that 7 million tons of marine debris go out into the oceans every year globally. And while debris from the tsunami presents a new source via the ocean for California, the only real response for that is cleanup. So I wanted to really highlight the fact that addressing debris from land really provides an opportunity to make a difference in reducing marine debris for California. There's lots of really good work going on in California, and today I want to introduce three speakers for you, and they'll be able to talk about the steps that California is taking to prepare for tsunami response and cleanup, as well as ongoing activities in California and along the Pacific Rim to decrease marine debris. Our first speaker is Mr. Steven Sellers. He's the Assistant Secretary for Response for CalEMA. And he stepped out. And no, he stepped up. I was starting to get scared. The second speaker is Evan Schwartz. He's the Marine Debris Program Manager for the California Coastal Commission. And our third speaker is Caitlin Gaffney, and she's the Director of the Pacific Program for Ocean Conservancy. So without further ado, Mr. Steven Sellers.
forever now known as the elusive Mr. Sellers. Secretary Laird, it's good to see you again. I'm glad to be here today to talk about our efforts centered around Japan tsunami debris. I think, first of all, I want to emphasize, you know, with the March event, our focus at CalEMA, obviously, California Emergency Management Agency, was the impact of the tsunami itself. We quickly, with NOAA's work and the Tsunami Warning Center, determined, you know, when the waves are coming, how big they are, the length of that event. We luckily, a lot of the emergency preparedness efforts we undertook over the years in terms of alerts and warnings and putting investment into things like reverse call-out systems or what's known as reverse 911 in a lot of the areas of the coastline were very effective. The local governments did what they're responsible for to let people know what's happening, to evacuate and that sort of thing. We did, unfortunately, have a lot of damage, especially in Del Norte County, and we lost Crescent City Harbor again. And we did have a FEMA disaster declaration as well as a state declaration, which I'll talk about briefly in a little bit and what that means in terms of where we are now. But quickly it became evident that the tsunami itself was not going to be the sum of our activities and what we need to be concerned with. First of all, obviously the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the nuclear release, the radiological release from that plant. We were working with FEMA, EPA, and others to do to find out, you know, what, you know, through the monitoring system, if we were going to have an impact in California. We did note some slightly elevated levels in some radiation, but it obviously, working closely with our public health department and so forth, it was never a public safety concern, but that was one of our immediate areas of attention following the tsunami. Somewhat related again to the debris and is that contaminated or not, and I'll talk about that. Then also the tsunami debris itself. You heard Sarah talk about what that estimate was. You saw the pictures. This massive material flushed out into the ocean from the tsunami. We, you know, the original estimate of the 25 million tons, working with NOAA and some of their modeling, that's now been revised down to about 1.5 million. Originally, it was this mass of material, this big floating mass. Now it's, with the churning of the ocean and so forth, it's obviously been broken up, and it's really hard to distinguish now, as Sarah said, what's normal debris from what's Japan tsunami debris, although we have a lot of anecdotal evidence. And when you find a jet ski in Del Norte, it's probably from the tsunami, or you find the motorcycle in the container. NOAA is the official recorder of what is Japan tsunami debris. But we've had some evidence, certainly, of more things like styrofoam and that sort of stuff reaching our shores. And establishing that baseline, which the Coastal Commission will talk about, is one of our key efforts going forward, is what is the normal level, then what can we associate with that tsunami debris. I think it was originally forecasted by NOAA that we'd have till about 2013 before the debris reached our coast. Again, as I said, as just said, we've had some anecdotal evidence that it's coming in. We certainly, if you look at Alaska and Washington State, Oregon, the case of the span of the bridge arriving on the coast, it's due to windage and other factors. Some debris obviously made it across a lot more rapidly than others. We're looking ahead in terms of our preparedness efforts. What will the winter storms do this year based on the ocean currents and so forth, the wind driving more material towards us? We really kind of accelerated our planning efforts because it looks, obviously 2013 is not when the stuff's arriving. It's arriving now and it'll continue to rise, perhaps as it rotates enough, for several years. Based on our early concerns, generally it was how much, when, what's in this mass of debris, you know, whether it contains hazardous materials, is it radiological? I must say that's been totally discounted at this point. In February, CalEMA sponsored a seminar or workshop at our headquarters with various state and federal and local agencies to kind of get our minds around what we need to be thinking about in terms of the response to this kind of event, what kind of guidelines we need to issue, what would be the response to this versus any other type of event in support of our local government, hazardous materials response, for example. Somebody finds something on the beach, gas container, how does that notification process work? Who gets notified? Who responds? And that was a very successful workshop, which resulted in some very significant actions, one of which is the establishment of a a information sharing website, you heard Disaster Debris at WordPress, and that is not only for the public, but there's a place there for the public information officers from local government all the way up to the federal government and on a multi-state and international level to share information, to share talking points, to talk about some of their strategies for reaching the public, the information brochures that are being distributed out on along the beaches to the public and so forth. So it's clear from the what we were hearing from the public, you know, what is it, when's it coming, the same things we're thinking about, is it hazardous, is it radiological? Our first effort was really centered on that public information campaign. And that has been a tremendous collaboration, again, between a lot of state agencies and at the international level. We also, with Cali EPA, US EPA, and the Coast Guard, developed guidelines for Japan tsunami debris contamination assessment. A lot of our local first responders working with us at CalIMA are wondering, you know, is there something unique about what we're going to see? You know, again, what's in this stuff? Are there going to be hazardous materials associated with it? And what is there anything unique about what we need to do in terms of our regular hazmat response? Essentially, it's not anything different for those responders. It's a hazardous materials incident. They know how to respond to it, you know, stay upwind, upstream, and all that, those good guidelines. But we wanted to reemphasize this is maybe unique. The calls may come into you in a unique way. It might not be a responsible party. It might just be somebody walking on the beach calling it in. And what do you need to do to respond? I think we also...
And responsible party is a legal designation.
Correct.
It's not that somebody's irresponsible by walking down the beach.
Correct. That's
yeah,
correct.
Just checking. Yeah.
The company that may have an incident. Correct. We also reemphasize the availability of our disaster debris management guidelines. CalIMA works on disaster debris management all the time, earthquakes, fires, floods, and so forth. And we've issued guidelines through our recovery branch, and we reemphasize the availability of those and reminding our local government how to manage this stuff, you know, what you need to do, how to do it, and if we have to trigger any kind of state response, how that would work. The Coastal Commission, which you'll hear from next, developed the Japan Tsunami Debris Volunteer Debris Removal Guidelines. And I think it's really clear for us at CalIMA about the important role that volunteers play along the coast and a lot of nonprofit organizations in terms of cleanup and monitoring and so forth. And I think, as you'll hear from Evan Schwartz in a minute, that's been a tremendous collaboration with us and from the traditional response community about how we're going to deal with this and if there's any, how we may be able to support those activities. We also develop CalIMA. We have our normal state emergency plan, how we have responded to disasters. We have our protocols. We have our procedures. For unique events, we develop what we call concepts of operations, kind of a military term. You may fight the battle this way day to day, but this is kind of unique, so you need to kind of be aware of some unique features of this event. That ConOps is just about ready to release. Our secretary is reviewing it now. I'm hoping when I get off my vacation next week, it'll be ready and ready to go. But basically, to make sure that we describe the roles and responsibilities from local government on up, so we all know how, who's responding, who's responsible for what, who does what, how we work together. In California, we have a very efficient and well-functioning emergency management system under our standardized emergency management system in the state. The principles of the incident command and so forth are well imbued throughout the system. But this is unique. We make sure we know that when a local government that's not used to dealing with these kinds of things finds something, you know, who do they go to at the state level for things like invasive species? So we have that embodied in there as well with the Department of Fish and Game and their responsibility for managing anything that may come in that has invasive species. Also, we established the Japan Tsunami Work Group as a mechanism for ongoing coordination among state agencies and, again, with NOAA and other federal partners. That group meets regularly and talks about, you know, what we're finding, what we know, what we're doing, what needs to be done, and then going back to the respective agencies and making sure all that happens. We also, I mentioned earlier, I talked about the FEMA disaster. There's a lot of confusion sometimes about what a FEMA disaster declaration means. We did have a federal disaster declaration for the tsunami in March of 2011, but it's only for the tsunami, and that's about 60 days post-event, anything happened during that period. I'm sure as a lot of our local government representatives know, that can be a very challenging process to go through, especially when you know you're still going to get debris from an incident that was over a year ago, but it's not going to, it's not anything you have now is not going to be associated with cost recovery from that event. So we've been a lot of information about what that means, and if we do have a new event, what would require to get another declaration and get funding and so forth to support local activities. Now, that funding issue has been a big one. A lot of our local governments, of course, are asking us, you know, what might be available. To date, Washington State recently announced some funding, state funding for their local agencies. To date, NOAA has offered, and we've accepted, and CalEMA is the coordinating agency for this, or the administrative agency, $50,000 for each of the states for disaster debris cleanup. As that got to me and our secretary, you know, what do we do with $50,000 is the basic question. We have how many counties along the coast? Quite a few. And if you start doing the math, if you start just breaking it out kind of in our traditional equality-based approach, it's not going to amount to much locally. And a lot of dialogue with our local emergency management partners telling me basically that is like it's going to be more to administrate it than it's going to be worth getting a small amount of money. So again, knowing how a lot of the cleanup happens, we did decide to work with Cal Volunteers and the Coastal Commission to support those ongoing volunteer cleanup efforts with that funding. NOAA just recently awarded it. We're working through the particulars of passing that money to the Coastal Commission for their use. And I think that model is kind of what we want to do going forward if any other funds become available. And there is talk, especially from the Republic of Japan, about providing some money for some of the impacted states. But we really want to support what's happening on the ground, and that's been our approach with this funding. And with that, I'll turn it over to Evan to describe what they're doing.
Thank you, Steve, and hello, Secretary Laird and council members. My name is Evan Schwartz. I'm the Marine Debris Program Manager for the California Coastal Commission. The Coastal Commission runs the state's biggest beach and inland shoreline cleanup events, Coastal Cleanup Day, and the Adopt a Beach program. And so from that standpoint, I'd like to first of all thank CalEMA for their recognition of the important role that volunteers play in dealing with debris along our beaches and our waterways as well. The grant might not mean much from a disaster management standpoint, but it means an awful lot from a volunteer cleanup standpoint. It's going to go a long way towards supporting affected areas. We'll be able to provide a lot more supplies, a lot more support, and provide direct financial aid to those organizations that are managing the volunteers on the ground. And the support is needed because volunteer interest is extraordinarily high right now, thanks to all the media attention that's being paid to the tsunami debris. And we want to be able to capture those volunteers before they get away from us and make sure that they're overseen by one of our trained volunteer managers. We want to keep them safe. We want to keep them directed effectively. And we want to keep them coming back to future cleanup events, whether it's tsunami debris or not. We'll most likely be seeing a lot of that interest playing out this coming Saturday. I'm sure it's already on your calendars already. But this Saturday is California's 28th annual California Coastal Cleanup Day. The cleanup is the state's largest volunteer event. Every year, tens of thousands of volunteers turn out to their local beach or waterway to clean up the debris that's accumulated over the past year. Now, most of the debris that's on our beaches is coming from land-based sources. But since this is a different incident than we deal with normally, volunteers at select locations on the coast this year will participate in a new data collection effort that's geared specifically towards identifying potential tsunami debris efforts. NOAA set up an email address, disasterdebris@noaa.gov, where anybody on the beach who finds anything suspicious or potentially from the tsunami could report it, and it would be cataloged. We've received 59 reports in California to that email address, but none of those reports has been confirmed to be tsunami debris. NOAA's confirmation process is very thorough, and it requires definitive identifiers like ownership markings or serial numbers that can be traced back to a region or even to a specific individual. Our data, on the other hand, will serve as a baseline against which data from future cleanups at those same locations will be measured. By examining the trends that we find from that data and combining it with the data that NOAA is getting from their 13 formal monitoring stations up and down the coast, we should be able to determine when or if tsunami debris is starting to arrive in bulk. That's going to help us better direct our volunteer resources and the other resources of the program to the areas that are most in need. In the midst of all this, though, we're continuing to educate Californians that marine debris is not a new problem for our state. Sarah mentioned the 1.5 million tons of debris from the tsunami versus the 7 million tons that's dumped into the ocean worldwide every single year. I want to emphasize that. That 7 million tons is a 40-year-old number, so it way underestimates what we're most likely dumping into the ocean every single year. The tsunami debris is essentially a drop in the bucket compared to what we face on the California coast every year. And frankly, a part of me wishes that the only debris we found on our coast was coming from disasters like the tsunami, because it would mean we'd have a lot less trash on our coast and that we had found real solutions to addressing the problem at its source from land-based sources before it has a chance to impact our oceans. Anyway, regardless of the source, the Coastal Commission's Coastal Cleanup Day and Adopt-A-Beach volunteers will continue to clean our beaches of whatever washes up, no matter where it comes from, and continue to keep California's coast safe, clean, and beautiful for all of us. With that, I'll turn this over to Caitlin Gaffney.
Thank you, Eben, and hello again. Caitlin Gaffney, Pacific Program Director with Ocean Conservancy. As Eben just noted, the coastal cleanup is coming right up on Saturday. I'll actually be out on the beach with 90 elementary school children tomorrow at Seabright Beach in Santa Cruz, California, Secretary Laird's hometown. So if you're in Santa Cruz tomorrow, feel free to come by around 10 o'clock and pick up trash with a bunch of elementary school children. You don't have to answer right now. No RSVP necessary.
There is so much to say in response to that.
Indeed.
You were just looking for a peer for them.
So Ocean Conservancy is the sponsor of the International Coastal Cleanup. This is a global event, happens the third Saturday in September every year. Last year, we had 600,000 volunteers participate in nearly 100 countries around the world. So we work with partners, of course, like the Coastal Commission. Eben has described the activities here in California. California is one of our strongest partners. But we have partnerships around, really, the globe. With statewide coordinators, incredibly important to the local volunteers. The folks that go out and collect trash during the International Coastal Cleanup don't just pick up the trash, but they also document everything that they're finding on a data card. We then collate that information at Ocean Conservancy and present it in a trash index. I have copies for you of our report from last year. And then that information can be used to try to really reduce trash, including in the Ocean Protection Council's own document to address ocean litter that came out a couple of years ago. So when the Japanese tsunami struck, the first thing that we did at Ocean Conservancy was reach out to our partners in Japan. There's an organization in Japan called JEAN, the Japanese Environmental Action Network. They've been running the coastal cleanup and trash avoidance and reduction activities in Japan since 1990, close partner. We contacted them immediately and spent the next several months trying to offer them whatever assistance that we could to deal with the tragedy on their own shores. In more recent months, as tsunami debris issue has become heightened awareness here along the West Coast, we've realized that while the government is taking steps to try to respond, as we've heard from Stephen and Eben, really it is the volunteers who are likely to be the first responders, and in many cases probably the only responders able to address some of the marine debris issues as they wash up along the West Coast. And there's sort of a good news, bad news there. The good news is we have excellent statewide coordinators throughout the West Coast. Obviously, the Coastal Commission, as I said already, a terrific partner, but also in the states of Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and also in British Columbia. The five West Coast states actually make up fully 50% of the U.S. participation in the coastal cleanup. So half of the people participating in the U.S. come from just those five states. We have a lot of folks on the ground who are going to be interested and eager to help. And we have coastal coordinators, the statewide coordinators, who are incredibly able and are taking this seriously and will be there on the ground trying to do whatever they can. The bad news is
that it looks like this is going to be a pretty significant problem, and the worst is certainly yet to come. There's a strong sense that particularly on the more remote beaches, the tsunami debris is going to be a significant issue. We're also quite concerned about the potential for introduction of invasive species. You've heard mentioned this dock that washed up on the beach in Oregon in June, covered in several species that have been identified as being at risk of being pests along the West Coast. So that's certainly a concern as we move forward as well. To date, no tsunami debris has washed up that we know of in Hawaii. Pretty limited items, as you've heard already, from Eben here in California and in Washington and Oregon, with the exception of some of those dramatic items like the dock that did wash up in Oregon. But Alaska is already being pretty hard hit and may be sort of the future for the rest of the West Coast, hopefully not. But what's happening in Alaska, we actually sponsored a cleanup on a remote Alaskan beach a few weeks ago. Ocean Conservancy and NOAA helped sponsor a cleanup. And what they were seeing on that beach is very large volumes of large pieces of essentially construction-grade styrofoam. The beach was just littered with large blocks of styrofoam. The photos are pretty interesting. We can forward them to you if you'd be interested in seeing them. And the concern that our Alaska State coordinator expressed is, you know, those are big pieces of styrofoam now, but after the winter, they won't be. They'll be many, many, many tiny pieces of styrofoam probably scattered throughout all of the remote beaches of Alaska, and at that point, really impossible to clean up. So obviously, pretty serious concern going forward over the coming months and years. It's important to recognize that the debris from the tsunami is quite different than what we usually find during the coastal cleanup events or monthly or weekly beach cleanups. We're talking about items that are going to be larger and in many cases more difficult to collect than sort of your average picnic debris. Housing and construction materials, fishing materials and vessels, potentially dangerous items such as combustibles, and also the sensitive issue of personal items that may have belonged to victims. So in an effort to try to help address some of these problems and prepare our volunteers, last month Ocean Conservancy brought together the statewide coordinators from California, Eben was there, also from Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, and Oregon, with folks from Japan and Gene, the organization we work with there, in addition to the Japanese government, to meet in Portland and essentially exchange information, build relationships, so that we have an even stronger partnership going forward through this crisis together. One result from that in-person meeting was a webinar that we were able to host last week. I think this was actually Evan's suggestion at that in-person meeting, where the statewide coordinators from throughout the West Coast region each presented on what they're seeing on the ground, what their concerns are, and we hope that those conversations will continue in the months to come so that we can be working as closely together as possible. Specifically, we will be reaching out to our West Coast coordinators and the folks that they work with to try to provide them with the best information and tools possible. We have just developed a tsunami debris identification card. I have copies of this for you to let people know, these are the kinds of things that may be showing up on the beaches related to tsunami debris, and then also getting the word out on those websites to report suspected tsunami debris. So over the months to come, we'll be continuing to work with our partners throughout the West Coast and in Japan to try to do the best we can to respond to this situation. And in conclusion, I just wanted to note that although it's perfectly appropriate that we're here talking about marine debris, especially with the cleanup coming and the concerns about impacts to the West Coast, this is a big problem, a big issue, as we've talked about. But also not to lose sight of the fact that the tsunami was really first and foremost a human tragedy for the people of Japan. And sometimes, as we start talking about the trash side of it, I think we can lose that focus. I was extraordinarily personally touched by the announcement that the government of Japan wanted to help us by providing potentially $6 million to help clean up tsunami debris along the west coast of the United States and British Columbia. So sometimes this issue can seem daunting, the scope is large, but I think the partnerships that we have trying to address this problem are also large in scope. So I remain hopeful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here and for providing your comments. I also just wanted to open up the floor for questions and wanted to mention that Ms. Sherry Lipiette from the NOAA Marine Debris Program on Detail to California is also here if you have questions for her.
I have a question, but we have one speaker. So why don't I ask the question and he can move up for when we're done with that answer. And it's Tony Marino from Assemblymember Jerry Hill's office. And let me ask the question, and maybe the best person to start is Stephen Sellers. But everybody mentioned in the most high-profile piece of debris seems to be that bridge dock, whatever it is, that landed on the coast in Oregon. And in the stories, the very interesting thing was is that immediately people descended on it and swept it for invasive species and did other things. Let's just say that 10 minutes from now you get a call that a similar thing has landed on the coast of Mendocino. Who actually responds and what's their protocol? What actually happens if that happens in the next few minutes in California?
It's a local, it depends on where it lands, first of all, obviously. If it lands on a state beach, state parks would be the responsible responder. If it lands local government, it's a local agency. The Gulf call probably go to the fire department. Fire department, based on our guidelines, will identify it as unusual and tsunami, probably tsunami related. Our mutual aid system is based on an operational area concept. They should be calling it into their county emergency management agency. You'd probably go through the environmental agency first. That's typically what happens with those kinds of responses. When would we get notified? We may get notified fairly quickly, CalEMA, because we want to make sure that Fish and Game is aware. That's kind of our key partner in this whole invasive species activity. So we want to make sure that they are, when will I can't promise.
Well, you see, what I'm trying to drive at is we have this little luxury of the fact that it hasn't really hit California yet, and we have the time to be prepared. And the real question is, are we prepared? If it lands, if that first one lands, do we have confidence that there's going to be a response, and a response with regard to invasives, and a response in a way that people don't circle it and play with it for a day before something happens?
Right.
I mean, how do we know that this isn't, that we've got these protocols in place and all the press comments afterwards where they didn't work? How do we have confidence that it's going to work?
Well, our CONOPS embodies that, and it also directs local government that when you become aware of this, to notify outside of your county, your local jurisdiction, county to us, so we can do what we need to do to make sure that Fish and Game and others, we've given them guidelines, we're communicating those guidelines to them.
Excuse me for asking just a really direct question as somebody that's worked with government on and off for 40 years. It's nice that you've checked the box to communicate. How do you know that they've received it, institutionalized it, and are in fact going to respond in the way that you anticipate when it happens?
The only best way I can tell you that is because we do it all the time.
You do it all the time and people respond appropriately all the time?
For the most part, I think that's true, yes.
Okay.
It's really directly related to our emergency management response and hazardous material response. That kind of response is well embedded in what we do every day. We get upwards of 200,000 spill reports into our warning center in California every day. That triggers certain notifications within the state family. We act on that all the time. So I feel, that of course that is the key is local government. And I can't guarantee up and down the coast everyone will respond as quickly as everyone else. But based on our disaster history, what we do with them all the time, what we've been trying to imbue with them about unique nature of this kind of thing. And that's why we did the CONOPS to put that kind of notice out. This is very different.
Well, then let me ask the obvious follow-up question. As a resident of a coastal county that is relatively urbanized, so you are not far from an urbanized area on any beach, even if you're on a remote one, 15 miles, it's still places that people are all the time. How do you deal with the parts of California, say Cape Mendocino North, that don't exist the same way and might in fact have tremendously remote areas that aren't always used by people or interacting?
Right. It's a huge challenge. We don't have a monitoring system in place to survey the coast on a regular basis. The NOAA doesn't have any kind of buoy, like the tsunami buoys, out there saying something's coming your way. It's kind of hit and miss when you talk about the ocean and what's out there and what's coming and if somebody sees it or not. They're doing the best they can with the fishery industry and others to say there's something out here and it's moving. So the likelihood you would get in a remote area might not be found for quite a time.
Okay. No, that's helpful. I want to continue with questions, but let's give the one speaker that's asked to speak a chance, Tony Marino. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, Secretary Laird, and members. My name is Tony Marino. I'm on behalf of Assemblymember Jerry Hill. He represents the 19th Assembly District and most of San Mateo County's coast from Pescadero to Pacifica. First, Mr. Hill would like to thank you for your attention to this issue and to that the attention of our state agencies, resources, Cal-EPA and Cal-EMA. I'm here, though, to express the concern of some of San Mateo County's local elected officials and staff that currently there's no centralized website to find California-specific information on tsunami debris. It's important to our local agencies because they are likely the first people who are going to be called when this washes ashore. Right now, we have a website for the entire West Coast, but unfortunately, some of our locals haven't found it particularly informative. And also, there's certainly information on each agency's website as well. Mr. Hill feels that a coordinated California-specific website would be an important tool in keeping our local governments, NGOs informed. Also, it'd be a tool perhaps for our state and federal agencies to use local governments and NGOs as well. And for that, I will just thank you for your attention to this issue.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sowers, is there anything you'd like to say in response to that, just to add?
Yeah, there was a letter directed to our secretary and other secretaries requesting that. The NOAA site is something that was stood up primarily for multiple state reporting. We've had a bit of email conversation among the relative agencies the last couple days based on that letter. I think the letter was August 12th.
Let's just stipulate it sometime.
It was fairly recently. Yeah, it's coming. We're certainly interested in knowing what's coming to California, and we're going to discuss among the relative agencies that are concerned about this, about where we can do that and how. So we'll pay due attention to that. We have to figure out whose website, who's going to own it, who's going to maintain it, who's going to talk, how we're going to communicate it. So we have some details to work through. But I think we certainly have, from CalEMA's perspective, an interest in seeing that California is taken care of and we're doing what we need to do. And if that's a strong interest and there's a local interest in that happening, I'm sure there is, we would likely pursue it.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much.
And if I might add that we recently received a copy of the letter and are working on a response. If you look at the Cal-EPA website, there is a tsunami debris information site there, which collates and provides links to both federal and state information that's available relative to the tsunami. And so I think actually that website does bring everything together, and you can use that to sort of branch off and see not only California tsunami program, but what the feds are doing. So most of it seems to be there on that website, though we would like to have a dialogue to see if there's something further we can we can add to that site. And then I'll just add that relative to the chair's question earlier about, you know, how do we know that we're going to get out to the locals, there have been a number of webcasts that have been used to reach out to local governments. And I'll also say that, you know, I've been impressed in working at CalEPA with the relationship that we have with locals whenever we're responding to emergencies, spills, catastrophes, that sort of thing. There is a fairly well-worn pathway between local governments and the state, and I think that if we rely on that and continue to do outreach, such as meetings like this, that I think we'll be in a good position to respond to any problems that might arise related to the tsunami debris.
Thanks. Thank you. That's very helpful comments.
I have one more comment. I'm sorry. Do you have a question first?
Actually, I did. You know, a lot of the discussion has been on beaches and beach cleanup and stuff washing up, but there's thousands of recreational boaters that are out going along the coast, and I wonder, are there notifications to marinas or the notice to mariners? I mean, are we outreaching to that group who might just pick something up that they see and then cart it back into, you know, the marina?
I'm not sure if I can answer that question.
Is there anybody that can take a whack at that?
Possibly.
There's somebody behind you that's signaling.
I'd like to introduce Ms. Sherry Libiart, who can probably answer that question better than I can.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, I'm Sherry Libiart with the NOAA Marine Debris Program. Regarding the at-sea hazards, we've been working really closely with the U.S. Coast Guard, and we have issued a number of different permanent sort of notifications to the entire North Pacific Basin for commercial and recreational vessels to sort of be aware. At the same time, anytime that there is a sort of a specific item that's sighted and reported back to either NOAA or the Coast Guard, that does go through official channels to get specific notice to mariners issued.
And that's a very good question, because I'm aware of a former legislator that did legislation on boat inspections for invasive species on the coast, but I don't think it was ever contemplated that you'd grab something out of the sea that might be floating that might raise its own issues. It was more the hulls and what the hulls might have picked up or other things in that process. So that's a very good question. Other questions or comments from members of the council?
If there are no further questions, I'd also like to mention that the Ocean Protection Council Marine Debris Steering Committee, which is a group that is composed of a number of agencies, the Coastal Commission, Department of Fish and Game, Cal Recycle, and others, has recently reconvened, and we've identified communication around tsunami marine debris as a priority. So government agencies are coming together. We are meeting. We're identifying what information needs to be shared and how it is that we can best serve the state of California with communication around this issue. So for instance, one of the things that was raised, marine invasive species, we're working to come out with develop a regional strategy into a more California-specific strategy and work with other issues around marine debris.
Thank you very much. I just want to thank everybody for participating in this, because I sort of had a role in initiating it because I was concerned that we had not been talking about this enough and that everybody wasn't aware of what was going on, and I found it a really productive item today. So thank all of you for doing this. We'll move to item number 9, which is council member requests for future agenda items, which is in essence a new thing. Would you like to explain what your desire was here?
My desire was to hear from the council members if there were any burning issues that you wanted us to prepare for the November agenda or future agendas, if it would take us longer than November to bring something to you.
And I think there's a chance that you're just offering the fact that we'll have this as an item. People are not obligated to do it, but they could also talk to you between meetings if they they desired to do it. So they don't have to think of it this moment. But I think that's a good addition to the process. Does anybody have anything they would like to suggest to CAT at this moment? Then seeing none, we are going to go to item number 10, which is public comment on non-agenda items. And I have four requests to speak. The first one is Joe Giever from the Surfrider Foundation, and Layla Monroe is on deck.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary and council members. try not to take too much of your time. While this isn't on the agenda, I haven't had the opportunity to come before you and thank you for putting integrated water management on your strategic plan. I think it's really critical that the OPC get involved with the definition of integrated water management and help coordinate multiple agencies to bring true coordinated, holistic, and multi-benefit reforms to the way we want manage water in California. COPA and of course the OPC was adopted in part in from recognition of quote unquote fragmented governance in the two ocean reports published several years ago. And we think when you look at water management from the 30,000 foot level, you know, you look at water supply and pollution prevention and habitat restoration and sediment management and marine life management and flood and wastewater management and the whole big picture, it really does, not to be critical, but it really does kind of present the poster child of what they were talking about in fragmented governance. And so I also wanted to take this opportunity to thank Director Coleman for attending DWR's water plan update plenary session yesterday. As you may know, or hopefully know, this is the first year that DWR is looking at coastal and ocean issues in their water plan, and we think that this is a really excellent opportunity to identify the benefit of integrated water management or the multiple benefits of integrated water management planning for our coast and ocean. And so it was an interesting kind of initial dialogue, but I think it's fair to say that DWR is going to need a lot of assistance drafting this section of the water plan. And so we're hopeful that that you can at least give Director Coleman the leeway, if not the directive, to continue working with DWR as they flesh out that section of the water plan. We have been and will continue to comment and assist in drafting that, but because this issue takes the coordination of so many different agencies, we think that the OPC can play a really unique and important role in drafting that water plan. That's pretty much it. I guess I'll end with this thought that we recognize that integrated water management is a big thing to bite off and chew, and that it's certainly not going to happen overnight. May not even happen in my lifetime. But certainly it's so critical to so many issues in our coast and ocean that, you know, the time for crafting the definitions and a roadmap for implementing integrated water management has come and gone. I mean, we really should have done that a long time ago. And so if nothing else, we should get that roadmap done as soon as possible so that we can avoid investments in things that are broken, that things that need reform, and invest those in things that fit the vision of future integrated water management. So once again, we very much appreciate the OPC at putting this in your strategic plan and look forward to working with you towards definition and implementation. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your comments. Next is Layla Monroe, and then Sean Bothwell is on deck.
Thank you, council members. On a very related note, I'd like to share with you some thoughts that are contained in a letter that I submitted earlier this week. It was signed by the Natural Resources Defense Council and six other ocean-focused organizations, Surf Rider, CCKA, among them. And that letter addresses our concerns, our growing concerns around the planning for siting of and oversight of desalination facilities. But we also have identified what I think are very exciting opportunities to put to use some of the existing tools that the Ocean Protection Council has spent quite a lot of time and resources to develop. So from NRDC's perspective, in the last year, working with my colleagues in the Oceans, the Water, and the Energy Program, we've realized increasingly that desalination is a very complex issue that, you know, while at first it may seem like a sort of genius idea of biblical proportions to just turn all of the ocean water into fresh drinking water to supply our thirsty, or to meet our thirsty state's needs, as you look at it, it's incredibly complex, and it also has potentially very significant impacts. The impingement, entrainment, the brine disposal impacts are documented, but what we really don't know at this point are what the cumulative impacts of these 17 sites that are proposed along California's coast, plus the two sites, very large projects proposed in Rosarito, Mexico, that would supply water for San Diego County. So the layering of those impacts over the many other industrial uses of the ocean, and the fact that we are actually phasing out some of the open ocean intakes used by coastal power plants that are now being proposed to be used by some of these same desalination plants, combined with the fact that this is a water supply source that we don't necessarily need, and in most cases really probably don't need, because we can use water efficiency, groundwater recharge, and other far less costly and far less impactful water supply options. They are just not as exciting as giant plants. And so we really need to be focusing on those water supply options, as Joe outlined. And so for those reasons, plus the fact that the Ocean Protection Council, I think, is really reaching sort of a place of maturity with its role, its excellent strategic plan, and its identification of key actions for the years going forward. So the ask that I would make, and on behalf of my colleagues in the various organizations, is that the council and staff consider agendizing in November an examination of ways that you can meet objectives 9.1, 12.1, and 12.2 in the strategic plan, which are regarding integrated water management and addressing new industrial uses of the ocean, such as desalination, using some of the very sophisticated tools, the integration of science that has been collected through the Marine Life Protection Act process and the monitoring enterprise in an ongoing fashion, and the work that was done or is being done under Assembly Bill 2125 to gather some of this information together. So in our view, we see a really great opportunity to sort of make the lives of the various agencies easier, to provide a process for some scientists to come to the table and perhaps tackle some of the trickier, more complex issues, for example, around understanding and mapping the cumulative impacts that we're likely to see, understanding the sort of overlay of these new plants with all of the other existing activities in our oceans. So we would be very enthusiastic in working with staff and the council on this proposed set of activities, and I hope you will take it under consideration. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I haven't seen that letter yet. I'll look for it. Sean Bothwell, and then the last speaker I have is Richard Sadowski.
Good afternoon. Again, I'm Sean Bothwell with the California Coastkeeper Alliance. And as some of you may know, the State Water Board is currently developing a trash policy to control the discharge of marine debris and plastic pellets into our state waterways. As a member of the Trash Policies Public Advisory Group, I wanted to just take a moment to quickly update you on the progress of the policy's development, and in the hopes that the OPC will begin implementing its strategic plan marine debris sections objectives 10.1 and 10.2. This fall, the first public draft of the trash policy is scheduled to be released for public comment. There will be a public workshop following that, and currently August 2013 is the kind of goal for getting the policy adopted. Substantively, the policy will hopefully resemble the efforts taking place in LA with their trash TMDL. These efforts require LA to implement full capture devices on all of its storm drains to ensure that 100% of the trash is captured before it goes out to the ocean. For you that don't know, a full capture device can be something as simple as just a catch basin screen that prevents trash from entering a storm drain, or it could be as complicated as a vortex separator, which takes the energy from stormwater and separates out trash from the stormwater itself. You can think of a washing machine with your clothes stuck to the sides. It's kind of a similar idea. Los Angeles also uses some creative strategies to encourage cities to begin implementing source control ordinances, such as local bag bans, polystyrene food container bans, and smoking bans on the beach. The LA TMDL is ahead of schedule. It was under budget, and it is already showing its effectiveness. So we are hopeful that when the Water Board's trash policy does come out, it will be implementing some of these strategies. However, like any good policy, it will face some challenges as it comes under public scrutiny. I'm here today to ask the OPC to support the State Water Board's commitment to ending marine debris going out into the ocean. The OPC has been a true leader in marine debris issues with the OPC's 2007 resolution in 2009, including multiple studies and reports highlighting the concerns of plastic pollution in our ecosystem. I would ask the Council to begin immediately implementing several of the proposed actions under the marine debris section of the strategic plan. Specifically, the Council can do three things that I kind of pulled out from the strategic plan that can help this trash policy. One, it can reconvene the Marine Debris Steering Committee to coordinate statewide efforts to reduce trash in the ocean. Two, support the State Water Board and other agencies in adopting and implementing a statewide trash policy and associated regulations. And finally, inform statewide policy discussions related to marine debris by conducting workshops, sharing information, and funding studies such as an economic analysis of marine debris and derelict fishing gear. We look forward to working with the OPC to help them promote the efforts and work being done statewide, specifically at the State Water Board. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next is Richard Sadowski, and we have a new last speaker, Marla Jo Pruden.
Richard Sadowski, representing the citizens opposed to acoustic seismic testing in the Sterile Bay area. This particular issue has been fast-tracked through the government agencies here, and as far as the local public notification has been very limited. It's basically getting more attention now. There was a Thank You Whales campaign on Labor Day in Avila Beach, and has galvanized the community, fishermen, environmentalists, concerned citizens. To me, when I think about testing, I used to work in the aerospace industry. I built launch pads for the National Security Council years ago. And there's a certain common sense when you go to test something, if to get a result. This particular action is to test for seismic or fault line data on a nuclear power plant that's been known to be built on a nuclear on Diablo Canyon, built on a fault line, and it's not irrational to think, and there's many that believe that this seismic test has to do with. Was developed for the oil exploration in the oceans, and it's not irrational to think that it's to locate oil deposits and other issues with under the auspices of seismic testing. Now, this is the mortality rates for the mammals regarding this is under. The U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is already investigating the mammal mortalities regarding seismic testing. If you want, you can Google some of the things that occurred in Peru. Google Peru seismic testing, and you can see what has gone on there. I am appealing to you as a human being and look, you are all given positions of authority and accountability. And if you look into your hearts of what is going on here, what we're leaving for our grandkids. I mean, I have a 4.5-year-old grandkid that I have to try to keep up with lately. And to explain to him why we do certain things and what are we doing? How are we, you know, people talk about like the World Futures Council talks about the seventh generation. Let's just talk about two generations. They're living right now. Let's just look at that. Two generations. What are we doing here? The Cali OPC is elevated to a global stage right now. And the assault on the MPA our whole MPA process is on the stage right now. We have to take action, maybe in a agendized item, or we can at least put a stay on this and discuss it. Maybe have the scientific advisory team. Let's just take a look at this and what is really going on here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Marla Jo Bruton.
Good afternoon, Marla Jo Bruton, North Morro Bay, and I'm speaking as a citizen and as a citizens opposed to acoustic sound testing member at large. The proposed sonic acoustic testing at the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant has very recently come to the attention of citizens. The process, as Mr. Sadowski said, has been extremely fast-tracked through the state process. The State Lands Commission has approved the testing. It still has to go to Fish and Game. Fish and Game has said that, you know, I don't have a quote, but that nothing would be left, something to that effect. We're talking larvae, we're talking mammals, we're talking fishing industry. The fishermen in our area are just besides themselves. They've been worked through the MPA process with the state. They're reaping the benefits of that by improved catch. And now we find out that they want to go from Cambria to Guadalupe, dragging the sonar equipment, that 240 decibels of sound every 15 seconds, 24 hours a day. And I think this time, speaking as a humanistically. We have people that I love the whales, okay, so cetacean people, dolphin people, what have you, and we're trying to help them. I truly believe in my heart that the whales that we have been seeing on our California coast know that this is proposed, know what is about to occur, and they are coming up and letting everyone see their magnificent beauty, their magnificent strength. They come right up in the middle of kayakers, surfers, boats, right the Port San Luis, which is the harbor that is adjacent to Diablo Canyon, came right, humpback right in the, right into the harbor there. And what that did is, because of the beauty, because it made national attention, you know, got national attention, this beautiful California sites, what it did is parallel to the fact that we are just now finding out what about this huge assault that is planned to occur. Now, I know that there's, you know, PG&E, and there's the investors of PG&E, $10 billion. I'm here to speak for the ratepayers for PG&E. We count, too, the people who live here that make this area, our area, California, our home, who love it for its unique beauty. We have a say in this too. And so if there's socioeconomic ramifications, I'm here to tell you that there are a lot of different ways of looking at socioeconomic damage. And the damage to the sea life here and the long-term, we don't know the long-term repercussions. There hasn't been studies. And as my friend Mr. Sadowski says, we can't just keep sticking the thermometer in the patient. Oh, yeah, it's sick. Oh, that fever's going up. Yeah. Why on earth would we at this time allow this to occur? And, you know, if you haven't heard about it, then check it out, okay? Please, thank you.
Thank you very much. That completes item 10, public comment. Our last item is just arrangements for next meeting and adjournment. Do we have a date for the next meeting yet, or are we still checking calendars and we have a ballpark? So just for future reference, we should put it at the end of the agenda, so it's on there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just for the record, the seismic testing that they're talking about will begin, I believe, on November 1. So if we're not meeting again until December, most of that will have been done by the time the Ocean Protection Council meets again.
And our next meeting is scheduled for November 29th here, same place, same time,
okay.
Same place.
We'll note that, and we'll see if there's a way to take the concerns into account in a timely fashion. So is there any further business?
I'll just note that I do take the issues relating to desalination very seriously. Whether it's the OPC, whether it's an informal collaboration of the various agencies that have an involvement with desalination issues, you know, which the right path to go ahead here is something that you know, I intend to give some consideration to in the future. I'm not really prepared to say exactly how I would recommend that we proceed at this point, but I just want members of the audience to be aware of the fact that, you know, clearly I'm aware of the issues dating back to my many years advising the California Coastal Commission. It's just a question of, you know, what's the right path forward, how do we proceed, and so it's just something that I'll be giving some thought to in the days, weeks, and months ahead. So I just wanted to note that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that, support that. Any other business? Then thanks to everyone for a very efficient and effective meeting. We will stand adjourned.